Good evening, everybody. This is National Liberty Alliance.
From Arizona.
Yeah, where the meeting started. Let's mute everybody.
I thought we were going to be on the 681 number.
Oh, I don't know. Did they change the number? Is that why I had trouble getting in? Nobody told me.
That's the last email I received. I received from John Derrick.
Hey, Jan, do you know about the meeting number changing, the phone
yes.
number?
Yeah, John sent out an email. If you went through the Monday call route, the new number should have been automatically entered. If you went through Skype or telephone, you've got to use the new number and an access code, 6 digits long.
Oh, well, I must be on the new number then because I just went in the normal way I always go in.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's automatic that way.
Yeah, so I guess this is the number then. So if you're here, this is the new, supposedly the new number. Who's asking me that question? Is that?
Ben from Arizona.
Ben from Arizona. Well, you're here, so you're on, somehow you got the right number.
Yeah, Ben.
I've got to go backwards.
The number for phones now is 681-999-0144. That's 681-999-0144. And you'll need an access code, which is 289459. That's 289459. That's in the newsletter, too, as well as it's on the Monday call on the website.
How come I don't see where to put this in lecture? Is that mute mode?
That's Q&A.
Q&A, yeah.
So you muted everybody then. Yep, you're ready to go.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna start the introduction. Good evening, everybody. This is NLA's National Liberty Alliance.org's weekly meeting. It's 8:30, 2021. And John is not here tonight, so we're going to do questions and answers. I'll be pulling people out. And although we got a couple things I would like to do before we do that. Hey, Jan, how many questions do we have anyway before I get going? And anybody that wants to make a question, get in the queue because it's empty right now. Jan, you're muted. I'm going to unmute you. Hey, Jan, do you have any questions or announcements before I get going? I tried to unmute Jan and he disappeared.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have two questions for you.
Tonight. Okay.
I could maybe find three.
Okay.
Okay. I'll look.
I want to play a video that I got over the weekend that I'm going to is pretty good. I mean, I can share screen. I could do that first, or I can wait until you're done.
Whichever you want to do.
It doesn't matter to me. Well, let me just make sure that. Brent said he'll be here in about 90 minutes. So he's not going to be here at the beginning.
No.
Let me see if this is going to work for me. Oh, yeah, but I have to figure out where I am. Okay. Okay, I'm going to start to share. Just let me know if it doesn't work. This old clunky computer. Do you see the woman's face?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to start this little tape. This is from Australia. Australia's been really taking it in the brunt. And really, they're kind of like our canary in the coal mine, what's going on over there. So I want to play this because people, this is coming here, and you have to realize this. But anyway, without further ado, here we go.
Can you run the volume up, Gerard? I can see her lips move, but I can't hear her.
How's that? Better?
Didn't make a difference. Is there a control on the video itself? Yeah, over to the right, it looks like.
I can hear you more. I can hear the movie more than I can hear you. But
okay.
I don't know. My sound is all the way up. Hang on, let me get on.
What about on the screen there?
Yeah, that's all the way up. It starts out all the way up.
Okay, try it again then.
Hey, wait a minute. Sometimes there's a goof up in this sound mixer, and one of these will be down when it should be. Yeah, I see the start meeting was low. See that? Nah. Imagine that. All right, let's try again. We'll get it.
Very low. Anybody else have that problem, Terry?
Can everybody hear this okay?
No.
No.
No. I just might not be able to get this just because it's a rumble thing.
But the visual speaks volumes about people coming and dragging a kid to get a shot.
It's disgusting.
And arresting the mother.
If you read subtitles fast, you could probably read the subtitles, but it's too low to hear.
Let me see if I can make this bigger. Can you see the subtitle there?
Yep, that's good.
Child being taken away, parent being given the jab. This is Melbourne, Australia. For everyone who called us exaggerators for comparing it to 1930s Germany.
Do you realize that a constant state good comparison serves as an excuse for global tyranny? How did you think the Holocaust began? Did you think mass genocide starts with public hangings? Or does it start with the systematic disarming and segregation of public citizens? So to those people I ask, are you going to hide your children like they hid the Jews? Australia is now the test model for this martial law to be rolled out globally. That's louder now. Rather than locking down 100% of the population for an illness with a 99% survival rate, why don't the 0.2% people that are truly at risk of dying from the virus simply stay home? For all we care, you can wear your 5 cheetah masks, take your 57th booster shot. You don't need a government mandate to be a neurotic recluse. People really need to understand that it is our compliance which is causing this perpetual process of medical tyranny. Let's not forget that the end goal is the V-passport. Without the V-passport, absolute medical fascism cannot be established. Without the passport, they have no leverage over the people. Without the passport, they have no advantage and authority to dictate the basic aspects of our lives. So it's imperative that we understand that it is the passport that are most crucial to initiate the Great Reset. Without a papers, please, social credit system in check, their new world order just falls apart. And if that seems like too much of a conspiracy theory to you, please explain to me why globalist institutions like the World Economic Forum are so excited calling the pandemic an opportunity. An opportunity for what? This whole psychological operation was strategically created to make you exhausted. Exhausted to the point where you give in and take a shot. And it was James Madison who once said that if tyranny and oppression ever come to this land, it will come in the guise of fighting a foreign enemy. And that foreign enemy in the 21st century just happens to come in the form of a foreign pathogen with a 99% survival rate. There is honestly no crueler tyranny than that which is perpetuated under the shield of the greater good for the greater number. So this is really just a friendly reminder that government officials aren't these benevolent leaders with your best interest at heart. They're power-hungry, perhaps semi-human creatures, capable of any evil to pursue their sadistic agenda. Freedom and liberty are always just one generation away from becoming extinct. So don't bend. Don't break. Stand strong. Do not comply.
This is not about controlling a virus. It's about controlling you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I had to walk away for a minute. Okay. That's that.
It's interesting, Gerard, that she quotes two American presidents near the end of her presentation. Did you notice that? Madison and Reagan.
Right.
And you're right, the Australians are they just need a lot of help. A lot of prayers, a lot of support.
Well, anything you see over there, that's what they're planning for us. It's no different.
That's true.
That's their MO right there. That's what they want. And like she says, you know, without the passport, they will not be able to ask you for your papers. So, and just like Naomi Wolf says, if they put that in, we're done. She knows it. I don't know if you saw the Naomi Wolf video, which I wanted to have for tonight, but I don't. But, you know, look at the... It's up to us to resist now. You can't sit home. You have to, like, basically, that's why we need our committees of safety, and we need to be talking to our sheriffs, because the sheriff is the last stand between these guys. And if you don't have a good sheriff, you forget about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So very important to get with the sheriff, with your group of committees of safety, and don't let them, you know, some of these real progressive liberal guys, you know, they'll tell you, oh, Committee of Safety, that's a terrorist. Guess what? All of our forefathers were in a Committee of Safety. All the signers of the Declaration of Independence were in a Committee of Safety. It's our heritage. It's not a terrorist organization, okay? And if we ever needed it at any time in history since the Revolutionary War, we need it now. You know, it's ridiculous. I want to also bring up this video that everybody should watch, because, you know, when you have discussions with people, you have to have the answers. If you don't have the answers, then they're not going to respect you, and they're not going to believe you. So, let's see. Not that. Let me see. I have a... okay, right here. I should have put the URL in so everybody could get this stuff, but I didn't think of that like we do for PSB. Let me try to get my screensaver up again. Share. Are you still seeing my screen? Am I sharing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you still are.
Okay. I never closed it down. I'm sorry. So this is a very, very good video. It's an hour long. I won't play the whole thing, obviously. But this is Dr. Thomas Cowan and Andrew Kaufman, interviewed by Mike Adams. And this, and Mike Adams, a lot of people don't like him because he, like, makes stupid jokes and stuff. I mean, I appreciate his humor, but maybe other people don't. But this is him at his best, because he's with these two very renowned epidemiologists. And Mike Adams is no dumbbell. He owns a multi-million dollar laboratory for food. That's what he does. He tests foods. He puts out foods. And so a lot of his expertise came in with these guys, and it was such a good discussion with these guys. And basically, they blow the lid off of this whole pandemic farce. It's unbelievable. And I recommend that everybody watch this. Now, this is on Brighteon, and you can put in there Thomas Cowan and Andrew Kaufman, and it comes up numerous times under the Health Ranger Report. Very, very good video. It's I'm going to just play the beginning of it and maybe a couple little highlights. But, you know, go on to Brighteon and find it. These are things that will give you the information that you need. Like my brother texted me. He goes, well, you know, I showed him, I gave him this video, and he said, I wish somebody would explain everything, you know. He said, because I say this or that to people, and then they tell me, you know, let me see if I can find that. It's a good idea. He says, we need to have one that explains all these hospitalizations that are fake, that they say, well, how do you explain all these people in the hospital? Because no matter what I see is people who are idiots like this, they always come up with something like that. So like when he says it's baloney, it's nothing, it's no worse than the flu, they go, well, what about all the people in the hospital? And so I said, if the hospitals are full, it's all side effects from the jab. Israel has the highest vaccination rate in the world, 80% or more, and their hospitals are full of COVID patients. The variant is the mutated spike protein in the shot. So they created that pandemic with the shot. So that's what they're not telling us, that all these people that they say have COVID, that they're all vaccinated. Also, they're still using the invalid PCR test, which is, I said 90%, but somebody said it's 95%, false positive. The CDC said they could no longer use it after December 31st. Why use it till then if it's false? Because by then they'll have their total control. They'll have their vaccine pass. So, and that's all they give a crap about. So, you know, when people say stuff, you have to be able to come back with facts. And those are facts right there that I just gave him. Here, let's listen to these guys for a minute just so that you get an idea.
In these genetic vaccine products, you know, we're not sure if the spike protein is actually made because, you know, it's not in the vaccine, right? The vaccine has the genetic code.
Okay, we can't hear again, George.
Because they wanted to avoid doing any studies related to shedding, which are required for gene therapies, they had this thing classified as a vaccine, so they could bypass that. So they've never actually studied, is the spike protein actually made in someone who gets these injections?
Welcome to Brighteon Conversations. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com and now the new Brighteon.tv broadcast platform. And today, I got to tell you, I am super thrilled to have these two guests on because these two brilliant men have changed my thinking about so many things. And right up front, I'll tell you who they are, and I got to offer them both an apology because I thought they were wrong for quite a while. Now I found out they're right, and it's going to blow your mind as you discover that for yourself. It's Dr. Thomas Cowan and Dr. Andrew Kaufman. And as I said, they're going to join me here in just a second. I thought they were wrong because they were saying, you know, you've heard this, that the COVID-19 virus has never been isolated from a symptomatic person.
I can't hear Mike. Gerard.
I'm sorry you said you can't hear it. Is that what you said, Jan? Hello?
Yes, that's what he
said.
Yeah,
I can't hear him.
I don't know what to do about that. Everything is up, 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 up. Is everybody else having that problem, too?
Yes, cannot hear.
Well, maybe this isn't going to work tonight with this. I don't know what else to do about it. It's too bad because I wanted to get the important point out to you. What he's talking about, this whole vaccine and how they've never really isolated it, and it's all a bunch of baloney. Let me just see something here. Let me just try something different. Maybe this will work. I don't know. Usually everybody hollers when I do this, but let's see if it
reduce the symptoms of the original diagnosis of the original source.
Can you hear that?
Yes,
is that
perfect.
It's coming through my speaker, so I'm going to play it like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay?
Thanks.
Pull that one out of somewhere. I don't know. Okay, here we go.
Isolated from a
I'm going to start.
I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighttown.com and now the new Brighttown.tv broadcast platform. And today, I got to tell you, I am super thrilled to have these two guests on because these two brilliant men have changed my thinking about so many things. And right up front, I'll tell you who they are. And I got to offer them both an apology because I thought they were wrong for quite a while. Now I found out they're right, and it's going to blow your mind as you discover that for yourself. It's Dr. Thomas Cowan and Dr. Andrew Kaufman. And as I said, they're going to join me here in just a second. I thought they were wrong because they were saying, you know, you've heard this, that the COVID-19 virus has never been isolated from a symptomatic person, you know, isolated, shown then to infect another person and reproduce the symptoms of the original diagnosis of the original source. And when I first heard that, you know, as a lab scientist myself, I thought, surely they must be wrong. Surely there must be certified reference materials of this, like a dried powder of SARS-CoV-2 virus that I can order as a lab owner, that I can order and get a certified reference material, and I can conduct studies on it. So I tried to order certified reference material, and this is when the awakening began for me, and I came to discover that so much of the field of virology is a mishmash of crazy woo goo, and they're selling basically snot stew samples to people and calling them isolates. And I had this huge awakening, so I had to get these two guys on to explain what's going on here and why COVID hasn't been, quote, isolated, and what that actually means. So Dr. Thomas Cowan, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, thank you for joining me.
Listen, I'm going to stop it for a second because I have a comment to make. I believe that the lawsuit up in Canada that the guy filed was exactly this. He said, okay, if it's COVID, show me where you isolated it. And he subpoenaed it, and they could not supply it. So technically, they don't have a virus. They never did. This whole thing falls on its face with this one fact that they don't have. They've never isolated it, so they can't prove it exists. But it gets even better because basically they got something that they have a virtual virus in a computer, and that's what they use to calibrate that stupid PCR test. But listen, here it comes.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
It's great to have both of you on. I've been watching so many of your videos over the last few weeks and getting an incredible education. But let's start at the beginning here, and if I could pose this question, Dr. Kaufman. Oh, by the way, we'll give out your websites here on screen for people to check out your work. It's andrewkaufmanmd.com and drtomcowan.com. But Dr. Kaufman, could you explain to people, just for starters, what do you mean when you say that we don't have an isolated SARS-CoV-2, a novel coronavirus that has been isolated and proven to cause this so-called disease? What does that mean?
Well, essentially, Mike, we have a situation here. If we're going to, you know, demonstrate that we've discovered a new organism, right, like they would say that a virus would be, then we have to show that we can find that alleged organism in nature and, you know, so that we can study it. We take a specimen of it and look at it in the laboratory, you know, like you do on a daily basis, and then we can dissect it and see what it's made of and take out the genetic material and sequence that if there is any. And I just assumed that that would be how they discover viruses, but what has happened is that since the 1950s, they have this procedure that they call isolation, but it's actually a complete inversion of the meaning of that word. And what they do is they have the possible or the putative source of an alleged virus or a possible virus in nature that they might have a theory as causing a disease, but they can't actually find it. So what they do is they take the diseased tissue from whatever organism and they mix it in a foreign cell culture, often using the cells of monkeys. But they do some further things to make this cell culture not grow well. They're not nice to it. They add poisonous chemicals, and they remove critical nutrients and create what I call a starvation diet. And then when they show there's damage to those cells in the culture, they say that that's evidence of a virus. And then they show electron microscope pictures of particles. But as we've seen, even the scientists in that field knew about this problem for a long time, that these particles they see are just what happens when cells break down in the process of dying. And they can't be distinguished from each other in any way, you know, based on appearance, or they've never been actually shown to exist separately in nature. And they've never been, you know, purified in any form that could be used for further study, like as a reference material that you mentioned. And, you know, they do have what they might call reference material available, but what it is that they just take the fluid from this cell culture and filter it and put it in a vial. And interestingly, and I think this is actually the purpose of why they use this experiment, that's the same exact procedure to manufacture a vaccine, because that same, very same fluid from that cell culture is essentially the vaccine material, minus the adjuvants.
But importantly, what's in that vial is not purified, is not limited to just whatever genetic sequence strain that they claim is in there. You know, when I buy a standard for my lab of, let's say, glyphosate herbicide, it's only glyphosate in water, right? And
yes,
it's just glyphosate molecules in water. There's nothing else in it, you know, very, very high purity. And it even gives me a concentration. You know, it tells me how many micrograms per milliliter of glyphosate is in there, so I can do serial dilutions, and I can make standards, and I can teach the instrument what it's looking at. What I've seen with these virology samples is not only are there no concentrations listed, no masses given of what's in there, but then the disclaimers say, oh, and it probably most of the genetic material in the vial is human cells and bovine cells. So I'm thinking, well, how is this an isolate?
It is really laughable when you look at it in scientific terms, because, as you know, you can take that glyphosate standard and run an HPLC on it and see a pristine, you know, symmetric peak.
Yes.
Whereas if you took this sample that we're talking about from a cell culture and looked at it under the microscope, you'd see a mixture of particles. And if you ran it on a gel electrophoresis, you'd see a mixture of proteins. And you'd see a mixture of genetic molecules, right, DNA and RNA. So it would not be one thing. It's a mixture of things. And that, of course, defies the meaning of the word isolation or isolate.
Right, and just to mention, electrophoresis, just to explain this to the readers, so that separates these particle masses by their mass-to-charge ratios, basically, right? So that it spreads out on a gel, physically spreads out particles based on their mass. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yes, it's a way to demonstrate, you know, what's in a sample in terms of a certain type of biomolecule, like proteins or RNA or DNA can all be separated, so that if you have, for example, you know, different genes represented, they would be separated and show up as separate pieces of RNA material, or if you had a mixture of proteins, the same thing.
So, thank you for that explanation. You're very clear about how you're explaining things. I want to ask you about Koch's postulates here next, but next question is to Dr. Cowan. So, what really shocked me about all of this is that once we understand that they don't have an isolated virus for COVID, it also turns out they can't prove that they have isolated viruses that are proven to cause polio or measles or other things. Can you give us your thoughts on the field of virology and this entire postulate that these viruses are causing these conditions alone?
Yeah, Mike, I also just want to point out that your example of glyphosate, it is appropriate because glyphosate is smaller than a virus.
It is.
So it isn't a technical problem to have pure glyphosate or pure something smaller than a virus. It's common laboratory stuff. So that's not the problem. The way I would answer your question is, you know, this question I keep asking people, how do you know there's a virus and it causes disease? And most people in response to that, including, unfortunately, a lot of medical doctors say, well, a lot of people in certain places got sick, so it must be a virus. or that a lot of people got sick and then spread to the next place, and that means it's a virus. Or my Aunt Bessie went to church and she got sick, and that means it's a virus. And the reality is, those are epidemiological observations, none of which prove any causation. That's not the role. And besides, if you think because a lot of people get sick in the same place, that proves it's a virus, you must think Hiroshima was a virus. If it spreads, then you must think Chernobyl was a virus. And the reality is, for hundreds of years, they thought, you know, one sailor got sick after another, their teeth fell out, they went into heart failure and died. That must be a contagion. Turns out it was scurvy and somebody ate a lime and the whole thing went away.
Exactly. So
we have a long history of being wrong about this. The next thing is, and here I'm going to say something that I think will hopefully shock your listeners who haven't heard this, because it shocked me, but if you say, okay, the next step is you take a sick person with measles, AIDS, chickenpox, COVID, whatever that is, any so-called viral disease, and you ask the question, is it possible to find a uniform, morphologically identical particle from any bodily fluid from that sick person? The answer is, if you look in the medical literature, there is not one case that that's true. Now, let me just tell you the people who agree with what I just said. Number one, 95, as of yesterday, health institutions have been asked, can you show me a study where a SARS-CoV-2, that's the virus, has been found in any bodily fluid of anybody with COVID? In writing, they say no. Then there's like the Pasteur Institute, the Robert Koch Institute, the CDC, all have said no. All the virologists who write papers saying isolation of SARS-CoV-2, if you ask them in writing, they say no. And here's another thing. Andy and I had the opportunity to present what we're talking about today to a group of lawyers and activists and doctors, and they invited a guy who was introduced to us as a laboratory pathologist and expert in laboratory virology in Wuhan, Chinese CDC for 20 years, and then a Yale pathologist for 20 years. And we asked him, is it possible to see an example of SARS-CoV-2 for any person with COVID? And he said no. And we said, why? He said, because there's not enough to see. And, of course, that's not the question of if there's not enough virus to see in an electron microscope, on what theory is it going to kill us all? But hang on. So Andy has...
Trust me, it's invisible. Yes.
Andy had the presence of mind to say, what about if you took 10 people and mixed them together, their bronchial fluid? Would there then be enough virus to see? And he said no. And Andy asked him, what about 100 people? And he said no. And he asked him, what about 1,000 people? And he said, there's not enough to see. And then we asked him, what about 10,000 people? You mix all their fluid together, would there be enough to see? And he said no. And then he wouldn't answer anymore. So the reality is, everybody who knows anything about virology agrees that you cannot find this uniform, identical, morphologically identical particle in the bodily fluid of any sick person. Not with chickenpox, not measles, not mumps, not the flu, not HIV, not COVID. So the question is, why did they write 10,000 papers or so claiming isolation? And that's exactly what Andy just described. They take fluid, they mix it with bovine fetal serum and calf serum, monkey stuff. They spread it on Vero cells, usually, or other types of cells. They poison it, they starve it, it breaks down, and they call that isolation, even though we now have two separate experiments that say, because the original experiment that did this by a guy named Enders, he actually did it control. And he did the whole tissue culture with nothing from anybody with measles, right? And he said, in quote, the result was indistinguishable. And when I read that, I thought, wait a minute, you just showed that the whole breakdown of the cell, which is what you're calling the virus, happens even if you don't add anything from anybody with measles.
Right, so they can find the virus in anything when they're just killing cells. They can find the quote virus. Right. So this is extraordinary, and I really appreciate both of you taking the time to restate these things. And I know you've talked about this hundreds of times. It's just that it takes a lot of repetition for a lot of us to get this, even myself.
Mike, this was, whenever you have to shift a paradigm like this, because, you know, we're really challenging germ theory here, it just takes a while to settle in. It's a process, but it can really help you look at all of the other scientific reporting that's going on if you realize that there actually is no virus to speak of. And what you see is that time and time again, the way that they do these studies is through simulations of various types. So they do actually virtual computer simulations for creating the genome sequence and for showing any potential benefit of masks, because when they study masks in the real world, they're not effective. But right. they've gone as far as to actually make what they call pseudoviruses of variants, because they don't actually have a real variant.
Now, pay attention, because this is important. This is what I want you to hear.
Because it doesn't actually exist. So what they do is they take a shell from another virus, empty it out, and put synthetic genes in there that they create in a lab synthesizer, and then they put that in a cell culture and mix it with, you know, antibodies that they say are this COVID antibody or that COVID antibody, and that's how they get information about the variants.
It's extraordinary, and I think the phrase they use is in silico, which means it's a computer simulation. And even when I've got to relate to you that I sat down with Thermo Fisher sales representatives, we were trying to purchase PCR equipment over a year ago for our food science lab, because we were trying to save time versus incubating salmonella samples and so on. So they had promised, you can do it in 12 hours instead of 72 hours by using PCR. So I said, great, come to our office, meet with us, show us how this works. So they came, and I had some questions for them, such as, you know, how do I tell the quantity? What's the quantitation capability of this instrument? And they said, there is none. It can't give you any quantity. And I said, well, how do I know if food is contaminated to a certain threshold, or is it just the presence of one strain of genetic material? I got to throw this whole lot out, because, you know, there are standards. There are standards, European standards. There's FDA standards. You know, even salmonella, total plate count, yeast and mold, there's a certain threshold. You go beyond that, it's considered contaminated. Below that, it's considered safe by the FDA. So you got to have quantitation. They can't provide that. And then I said, well, how, you know, where am I going to get the samples to run against? And they said, no, you just download them. And I said, what do you mean? What, I'm downloading salmonella now? What are you talking about? I said, no, it's just digital libraries, and then you can update them and you just download them, and that's what it's looking for. So you're absolutely right. That's when I realized it's all a simulation.
But they tell you, you know, if you go to the original Christian Drosten paper that where the PCR segments came from, the primers, now you have to understand there's...
That's basically, I'm not going to play anymore. You've heard enough. You can watch this yourself, and you should. It's amazing what they're, you know, talk about the Matrix. You know, it's like, it's all fake. It's all a lie. And they got us running around like chickens with the sky is falling, chickens with their heads cut off. And it's all a lie. So take it for what it is, that you should watch the rest of that so you can have intelligent conversations with people. Most people don't know this stuff. They take everything at, you know, face value, whatever they say. They believe the government. They believe the doctors. And the doctors don't even know, because the doctors depend on the salesmen to educate them, basically, of the different equipment. Just like Mike Adams said, he was gonna switch to a PCR test because it's supposed to do it quicker, isn't it? Well, where's the salmonella? Oh, you download it. I mean, think about that. That's ridiculous.
I'd like to add something, Gerard.
Okay, boy, you're low. How come I don't?
Because I didn't have my mic close enough to my mouth.
Oh, okay.
I just want everybody to remember that an X is a has-been, and a spurt is a drip under pressure. And these guys are all listening to experts.
Experts, right? Drip under pressure, huh? Anyway, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. I mean, it's almost, what do I want to say? Truth is stranger than fiction? There you go. Because it's all fiction anyway.
I wanted to make another announcement, too, whenever you get ready.
Go ahead, because I'm going to switch gears here pretty soon, but I want to bring up I got to go search on Amazon for something, so go ahead while I'm looking for that.
Okay. The message, buried down in the deep part, John forgot to put it into the top, is this new number takes effect on the 15th of September. So we're going to be here for another couple of times. Let's see. Tonight is Monday, August 30th. So that would put us two more Monday night conference calls here for two more weeks. And then the third week on the 16th, no, I'm on August. No wonder I'm so messed up. Okay, that would give us the 6th and the 13th. We would be on this number. And the 15th is a Wednesday. So the discussion group call on Thursday the 16th will be on the new number. And then we'll start having the new number. We'll start using it on the Monday night call on the 20th of September. I'm sorry this is so discombobulated, because I thought we had it down, and tonight I found out we didn't. I just spent about 15 minutes over on the other one and moved everybody over here. So I hope everyone made it. And then we'll go from there. Well, Gerard, you ready?
Yes, I am. This is something I ran across, and it's not the first time, but and I was hoping that when Brent comes, you can expand upon it more. It's called The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates, a Proper Resistance to Tyranny and a Repudiation of Unlimited Obedience to Civil Government. And there's a book that this guy wrote that's on Amazon. I'll share the screen in a minute here. But this, you know, they're always quoting Romans where it says, and they're misquoting it, saying, oh, you gotta obey the civil authorities, you know, because they have authority under God, and that is not true. That's only when they're not ordering things that are against God's law. Think about how stupid that is. Oh, you gotta obey the authority. Yeah, well, if the authority is telling you something that's against Scripture, I don't think you gotta obey them. And that's the point. So, hang on, let me get my screen share up again. I want to play a little bit of this. This is long, but I want you to hear the beginning of it anyway. And it makes a point that we really need to take into account today when we're wrestling with all this stuff. Come on, I can never find that silly button. There it is. Okay. Can you see my screen there?
I can see your screen, yes.
Okay, I don't know. We'll see how this guy comes in. I'm gonna start playing this for a little bit.
People need to understand things theologically. That's what gives people the teeth to stand against evil and not shake and cower, you know, in the face of it, but to do right by Christ. That's amazingly important.
Resistance to tyranny is obedience to God. That is actually, it was a common phrase during our founding era, and I think to a lot of people who have just read Romans 13 or have just heard, a normal pastor preach on Romans 13, they're like, wait a minute, why do we have to bow down to all tyrants no matter what they say? But in fact, that's not what the Bible teaches. That's not what many of the church leaders down through the ages have believed. And with us today, we have the best possible person to talk on this topic. His book actually changed my view on things radically, and it's done the same for many, many others. In fact, the reason I don't have the book with me right now is because I lent it to a friend. My friend liked it so much, he went and bought a copy for all the elders of his church, and it just so happens that some of our government leaders go to his church. So obviously, this is having powerful effects here. Now, with us today, we have Pastor Matt Trujillo. He is he wears many hats, lots of different talents and skills. He is the author of the book that we want to talk about today, The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates, A Proper Resistance to Tyranny and a Repudiation of Unlimited Obedience to Civil Government. Phenomenal book. I can't recommend it highly enough. I wrote about it in the New American like 6 years ago. We had an incredible response, and since then, the book has just been flying off the shelves from what I understand.
Actually, that is kind of the whole theme of NLA, really, when you get down to it. But anyway.
He's also the father of 11 children, the grandfather to 23 children, so the Lord has really blessed him in that respect. He is also the leader of Missionaries to the Preborn, trying to be a light and expose the evils of abortion. And he does a lot of other things. He pastors a church and just an all-around wonderful man. Pastor Matt, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, an honor to be here with you, Alex. Thank you. God bless you.
Well, God bless you as well. And so, guys, today we're going to talk first about what the Bible says on these things. And we're going to get into what church leaders and what the church has believed, and we're going to look at specific examples. And then finally, we're going to bring it back to the modern day, to right now, to today, when government, if you've been watching the show, you're probably aware, is kind of out of control, kind of going way beyond the bounds of what is permissible based on what the Bible says, and of course, based on what our U.S. Constitution says as well. So, Pastor Matt, tell us a little bit about what the Bible says about this. Because, you know, when you hear Romans 13 out of context, it's like, well, just, you know, bow down. If he tells you to kill babies, I mean, that's your duty to submit. Is that really what the Bible teaches?
It does not. In fact, one of the things I point out in my book, and by the way, we have an appendix available at our website, defytyrants.com, from the book, 14 pages long, just dealing with Romans 13, because what you brought up about Romans 13, Alex, comes up all the time. So it's a great help to people. They're able to post it and respond to friends, family, church members, that type of thing about it. But when you look at Romans 13, you'll notice that nowhere in the passage does it say that we're always to obey the civil authorities. Rather, men impose that on the text. It's what we call eisegesis. Eis is the Greek word for into. It's where you're reading into Scripture something that's not there. And so it's not there. Just read the passage. In fact, there isn't one verse in the entire Bible that says we're always to obey the civil authorities. In fact, it goes against good biblical hermeneutics to suggest such an idea. Because the hallmark of biblical hermeneutics is Scripture interprets Scripture. Scripture with a big S interprets Scripture with a small s. In other words, when you look at a particular verse, Scripture with a small s, you must look at it in the whole light of God's Word. Scripture with a big S. Scripture with a big S interprets Scripture with a small s. And when you look at the whole of God's Word, you see many places where the people of God did not obey the civil authorities, and God blessed them and commended them for not obeying. The Hebrew midwives, for example, with the male Hebrew children, were told to kill them. They refused to do so. Daniel was told not to do something bad, like the Hebrew midwives. He was told to do something, he couldn't do something good, like pray. He didn't obey. And that has been the standard for Christian men down through 2,000 years of church history, that when the state commands that which God forbids, or forbids that which God commands, we are to obey God rather than man. So this is an important thing to understand. Even Paul himself in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, who penned Romans 13, he talks in there in 2 Corinthians 11 about how he knew the governor wanted to arrest him. And instead of simply submitting to the governor, he craftily flees in a basket down the side of the wall to get away from the governor. So the idea that we are to always obey the civil authorities is not taught in Scripture in any way, shape, or form. In fact, the exact opposite is taught in Scripture, that, yes, we obey in everything and anything that's proper and right, but when they go against God's law or word or attack the property or persons of people, those types of things, then we are to obey God rather than man.
Anyway, you get the idea. It comes up so many times, and this book is available on Amazon here, Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates. And if Brent's here later, I'm going to ask him if he wants to expound upon any of this, you know, as far and maybe take it further, because I don't know if you know it or not, but the governments have sent all the churches passages and quoted Romans 13 to tell them to preach to their parishioners that they should obey the government. And they're telling the preachers, look, it says right here in Romans 13, you know the passage, blah, blah, blah. So you got the government quoting scriptures. That's like the devil quoting scriptures. Well, he knows scriptures, but he also knows how to misinterpret them. And what was that word he used about putting meaning in? That, you know, extra whatever, I don't remember, but, you know, there is a technical term for that when you put your own meaning on a passage of Scripture and make it mean something else. So I thought that was very important for these times and these days that we live in, because you got the government going to quote Scripture to us. Imagine that. They can't even come up with a real vaccine, or there's no such thing. And they're gonna also tell us, you know, how to live honorably and spiritually, and obviously they don't. So let me get rid of this, Jan. I know I stopped you before we had the questions, and we can go into that now. Let me just stop my screen share here.
Okay.
Get my thing. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry.
It's going to be a short list, Gerard, because the first question is about the books, and that would be for John.
Oh, okay. I know. I know he's still waiting for books. You know that he did not get all of them. You know. Yeah. So. Okay. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
We can pass over the book question. The next one concerns someone who wants to sell their apartment and thought they had a federal tax lien on it, and I see they're number one in the queue, so maybe rather than me trying to read what she sent it in two different ways, one finding that there was no lien. So maybe if you want to take Amy in the Q&A session now, would be better than me reading her brief statement.
Okay, I can do that. Let me get there. Am I still screen sharing here?
I don't know. I'm not looking at it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, you are.
I don't know why I can't.
Yeah, you are.
Make this bigger so that I can stop the share. Hang on. More. Yeah, it doesn't give me the stop share here. That's very weird. I don't know, so hang on, just bear with me a minute here.
Down below, there's a share button. Maybe you re-hit it.
Yeah, it wasn't on. There was a smaller thing, and it didn't have the button there.
It's on that green triangle at the bottom.
I got it.
There it goes. You're up.
Okay. So, back into my controls here. Let me get this stupid thing out of the way. I don't know why my mouse is so nervous. So, Amy, I'm going to unmute you, and you can ask your question, and I'll do the best I can to answer it.
Hello.
Hello, Amy.
Hi. I sent two questions, I think. The first question was, I got this interesting call, which, you know, they say the IRS will never call you. Be skeptical if you get a call from them, but he seemed for real. I got his name. I Googled it. It looked like he worked there. But he suggested, this is, again, due to the tax lien on my apartment, the ongoing saga, but he, in response to my certificate of non-attachment, he said, oh, you shouldn't file a certificate of non-attachment. You should file a form 12777, application for withdrawal of federal tax lien. So you could sell your apartment, take the lien off, sell your apartment, and then settle up after you sell your apartment with IRS. Okay, then I get home today, and I get in my mailbox, finally, after paying for it three times and escalating it to my New York Assembly persons. I started this, I think, back in May? I finally got the UCC 11 after paying for it three times and escalating it. So, which I think you said last time was a violation of my due process, which I'm not exactly sure what that means. But,
well, it's an offense that you can bring into the federal court because it's a violation of your inalienable rights, and they would have to take it. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. So, and just before I found that in my mailbox, my real estate agent called up, and she was really harassing me because I guess the buyer sent her, a letter, what's it called, time is of the essence letter to sell my apartment because I was supposed to sell it back in June. So now I'm supposed to sell it September 13th. But I was trying to get this lien off, but, like, I've been going in circles with Albany, you know, getting the runaround. So, I mean, so literally just today, the same day I get the call from her about the time is of the essence, I get this, finally get the UCC 11 search that says there are no federal tax liens under this debtor's name, under my name. So... So I guess that's the evidence I needed, but now what? Now what do I do?
That's a good question, because just because you have the evidence, who's going to uphold that? You need, you know, if you had a good judge, see, somebody that could judge that and say, yes, just she's right. I mean, you are right, but who's going to say that you're right? They're not going to take your word for it, right?
Yeah, right.
So,
my lawyer's you need to get a litigation lawyer. You need to respond to this time is of the essence letter to get a lawyer to send a rejection letter, or else they're going to come after you and sue you for any equity you have in your house. So,
yeah, and I don't doubt that they'll do that either, that they won't do that, you know. He's right. I mean, he knows that the slimy system that you're in there. So
yeah. So is he saying,
you know, like John always says, if they send you something, you have to respond to it. You know, in some way, shape, or form. Anyway, even I don't know particularly what your case is like, but even if you respond in such a way that it buys you time, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I guess I'm going to have to try and find some lawyer. I don't know if that's going
to
be.
You know, you have to. I don't know what that letter says or whatever, but, you know, there's got to be something you could deny there or ask for more proof of. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I put
some negative avertments or something.
I put the attachment in my email to you in the question email that attached the UCC search, certified UCC search result.
No, I mean the IRS. In other words, they're saying not the IRS. Who's forcing you to sell this?
I enter into contract to sell it, but then I found this tax lien on the title search. So when I start investigating it and asking questions to you guys. Way back when, and to freedomradio.us, Brent Johnson, That's where I got these instructions to ask for the form 4490 and 56, which I got the FOIA request. Neither of those exist. And then Brent Johnson said to ask for this UCC 11 search. Now I get that back. They said nothing exists. So I'm like, this could be another Matrix thing where you're like living in the Matrix.
They said the form 4490 and the form and the 50 don't exist, and they also said that the what was the other one that you were going for? I'm having a senior moment here. That you just got.
What did you? Oh, the UCC 11 search.
Did they say that? Did they say that didn't exist too?
Yeah, that's exactly what it says. It says
it doesn't exist, you know, but you got it.
There's no financing statements or any federal tax liens which the above named debtor, which are filed as of August 4th, 2021. Yeah.
Right. They're telling you that there's no lien that exists, right?
Yeah.
And you know that that's true because there is no lien. It was a notice of lien. It was never was a lien, right?
Right, right.
So it's, you know, it's a fiction. But when you're asking for Form 4490 and they're telling you it doesn't exist, you know, they're probably playing a game with you because it probably used to be called 4490 and then they changed the name, but they're not going to tell you that. They're only going to give you exactly what you asked for. So if they made it a 4490C and you don't know that, they'll say, no, we don't have any 4490. That doesn't exist. You see what I'm saying? That's why they're so snaky, and you got to be careful. Because we know for a fact that those forms used to exist.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you should be able to go back in time to whatever point and FOIA request form 4490 because they can't take it out of the record. You know what I'm saying? I'm thinking outside the box here. You know, don't tell me that form never existed. When did you stop using it? Type thing.
They don't have it was never completed or filled out or executed.
Oh well, you're not gonna find the form 4490 because they never filled them out. That's exactly the point.
Okay.
When they say it doesn't exist, I thought you meant the form doesn't exist. No, the 4490 doesn't exist, and they don't have fiduciary authority over you. Case done. If they said that doesn't exist, that's your case won right there. File it based on two things.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Because basically you won, just like that guy that said, show me the isolate show me where you prove. And they couldn't do it, and so they had to find for him. That's exactly where you are. It doesn't exist. They got no case. They got no lien. They got nothing.
So
you
now
won.
I need just somebody to help me file the case because I have no idea like how to do that, basically.
Well, wait a minute now. There is no lien, but they're claiming there's a lien. Where did you find the lien? It showed up somewhere, right?
The title search that the buyer paid for.
So what I would do is I'd get a hold of the title search company and I would say, your data is wrong because I have these documents that say it doesn't exist and you need to correct your title search.
Also send them both the FOIA and the UCC 11 and
Not only the FOIA, you want to send them, you know, the letter that says there is no 4490 in existence there and no 450, whatever it is.
Okay.
Because they never filed fiduciary responsibility on you, and they never filed the fact that they got a bill of goods on you. They never do that. But that's what's required under the law in order for them to exercise a lien or whatever.
Now, this is the other thing, though. I don't know if I'm going to get any traction with them because originally I asked the woman at the title search company, and she said, no, we have no documentation on this. So she said, we'll look into it. And I kept following up, and it was kind of like, I think you guys were told me on one of the calls that they're going to never have an answer for me. I'm going to keep asking them to follow up, and they're going to keep saying we're looking into it, but never come up with an answer.
Well, they did a title search, and they came up with a lien, and you, okay, so now you say, show me the lien. Where's the lien? How did they find that?
Okay.
What are they looking at? I mean, the title search should be specific. And what book and library page, where is this lien that you're claiming?
Yeah.
Where is it? Show it to me. And now
yeah,
you've got this other...
nothing.
They, why would they even, it has to be written somewhere. It probably says notice of lien, and they know that, and they're not going to correct it, because if they have to correct it for you, then they have to do it for everybody, and the whole ball and the whole game blows up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
That's
what you
that's
mean.
What my feeling is. I think that they're getting their light bulbs going off in their heads, and they're afraid to touch any of it, because it's such a, what you have there is an atom bomb, really. Think about it. No, we don't have this, and we don't have the lien, and we have no 4490. You have nothing. The emperor has no clothes.
So now my real estate closing attorney, she's like, you need to get a liens and litigation lawyer, and you need to first, you know, have them reject the time is of the essence letter and then see if they could get this lien removed. But I don't know where I'm gonna find.
I don't know why you have to have a lien removed that was never on there.
Well, yeah.
They want you to jump through these hoops and the reason you're jumping through those hoops, they're telling you to get the lien removed. Well, there is no lien. Why do you want to play a game saying that you're going to remove a lien and show me that it exists? I'm not going to pay money to pay some lawyer, litigation lawyer, to litigate something. That's like let's litigate about the emperor's clothes. He has none.
Right.
Is there anything else more to talk about?
To the title company and see what they say. But
unfortunately, I know you're going to end up suing everybody. That's the only way you're going to get them to do anything. You're going to have to sue them, and that takes time. And so you're going to have to respond to that time of the essence thing. And, yeah. I mean, there's kind of an extenuating circumstance, because there is fraud there, because there's a false lien. Now, I don't know, you know, look, if you had an honest attorney, and I hate, you know, I use that term lightly. If you had somebody that would actually go and do the work for you, it's probably 5 minutes work to prove that it's, you know, it's not there. It's fraud. You know, it doesn't take a big thing to show. You know, oh, remove the lien. Well, you know, the lien is, you know, this is the Borg. Resistance is futile, and they only want to know what they want to know. I just went through this with motor vehicle. It's so ridiculous, and nobody can even think or make a decision, and they just go by certain numbers and printed out forms, and in the meantime, they're doing tyranny, and they're making money for themselves. That's why they do it. That's what, you know, they say, oh, well, you know, this paper says this and this form says that, and that's all they know. And it doesn't matter.
My real estate lawyer said she doesn't even want to charge me because she feels bad, and I feel bad for her. Her father just died, and she's one of those people that drank the Kool-Aid with the vaccine, so I didn't even want to ask if he took the vaccine, but she took it. She was volunteering for her work, for being, I don't know where she works for, the bar or whatever, for all these vaccine. What do you call those injection sites? Which I was like, oh my god, but whatever. So I mean, like, she totally drank the Kool-Aid with the vaccine.
Mm-hmm,
and,
boy.
Yeah, I feel bad with everything that her dad just passed away and whatnot. But yeah.
Well, he was probably murdered with the vaccine, and she's the next one that's going to be murdered with the vaccine.
Yeah.
She's not doing anything to counteract it. And even then, it's questionable if you can stop it. But I don't know what else to tell you. I mean, I think you got some powerful document there. It would seem to me that the trouble is there's no good judges or attorneys or anything out there anymore. You know, to get a judge to give you an injunction on that paper, basically because of this extenuating thing, this lien. That's not a lien that's on there, you know? And technically, if you sell it with the lien on it, the lien has to be paid, right? That's the procedure, right?
Yeah, right. I'll have to pay $100,000 out of the closing costs to pay this lien off.
Well, couldn't you just go through with the sale and hold the lien money in escrow?
She suggested that actually.
And then you could litigate it later. And then what you do when you go back and litigate it later, you charge them for your trouble and your loss and your waiting and your anxiety. You know, you got to tack on some, you know, restitution for you, obviously. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. That's the best of my knowledge of what where to go. And that's just kind of trying, really being common sense, so to speak, you know.
So I guess now the next thing, I got to find a lawyer by tomorrow morning because my real estate lawyer says she can't handle this, you know, and she's going through a lot of other stuff with, you know. So.
Well, what's tomorrow morning? What's going to happen? What's happening tomorrow morning again?
She needs to respond to the buyer because otherwise they're going to schedule everyone to show up at the closing, and then, you know, it'll cost more money if it's scheduled and then it gets canceled. Everybody gets paid by the hour.
Right. So I don't know what to tell you, because if you move ahead, are you going to be allowed to put the money in escrow yourself? Well, no, you'd have to have an attorney do it. They wouldn't let you do it, probably. Although I would do it, even if they didn't want me to. But you got to get your hands on the money before you can put it in escrow, so that you have to have the closing, right?
Yeah.
And the lien is with the IRS, right?
Yep. Yeah.
So that you should be able to put that in escrow and hold it back. That should be very easy. I don't know why your real estate lawyer doesn't know how to do that. That's not rocket science. That's normal stuff. Just call her in the morning and say, listen, we'll have the closing, but you need to make sure that IRS money goes into escrow, because there is no lien, and I've got the documents right here that prove it, and there's not enough time for me to file them and have that acknowledged before the closing. So close, and the IRS can go pound salt until you litigate that out.
Yeah.
You know, and the buyers can get what they can get, the place that's what they want. They'll get what they want, and eventually you'll get what you want, because you'll get that lien off, and you won't take that big cut in your profit or whatever it is, right?
Yeah. Now so. I finally got a job. I just started the onboarding today, so I'm like, now I kind of wish I had never sold the place so that I could stay here. But yeah. You know, I signed a contract, so I guess, you know, I don't know. I guess she told me I need to call and get another lawyer by tomorrow morning. So
that ain't gonna happen. You're gonna be on the phone all night. Nobody's around.
Yeah, yeah.
Like tomorrow morning, you get really under pressure here. But that's the way it always goes, isn't it?
Yeah.
So see if she'll do it. If you can convince her to just take the lien money and put it in escrow and let them close.
Okay.
Because you know you're not violating the lien if there's money sitting in escrow.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's really important that you find an attorney to put the money in escrow, because if you put it in escrow, the IRS is not above going into your account and taking money out before you live. You see what I'm saying? Whereas if the attorney's holding it, it's going to be much harder for them to go in there and take your money out of that attorney's account that is in escrow waiting for your proof, your litigation to come through. But believe me, if you're holding it, they'll take it. They'll go in. They don't care. They'll go in and take it and tell you to go ahead and chase us for it, you know, because they really have no sense of lawfulness, any of them.
That's something other participants on this call might be interested in on tomorrow night, Tuesday nights at 9, is Brent Johnson's call at Nash. freedomradio.us. And so he offers all these, was it asset protection, like this common law trust, to so that you, I like that Chappaquiddick guy who, you know, killed that gal. Was it Mary Jo?
Capecchi, whatever her name. Yeah.
And it turns out he didn't have any money in his name. It was all in these artificial entities, you know. But so that's what this guy does for people.
Yeah, that was like, Kennedy that killed her. Yeah. And that's what the elite does. They don't have any money in their name. I don't know, nothing. They're smart enough not to put anything in their name, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's one thing people could do, I guess. So, yeah.
That's interesting. That's good information.
Yeah, he wrote the foremost book on, what's it called, American Sovereignty. His book is, I guess it's the number one book in the world.
What's his name? Repeat it again for everybody out there.
Yeah, sure. Brent Johnson. His book is called The American Sovereign. It's on freedomradio.us. And his calls are tomorrow at 9 every week. And there's a replay you can watch on the website. But that's what he offers. He offers... and on Telegram, he has a Lessons in Liberty, Brent Johnson Lessons in Liberty, where he talks about, you know, each amendment of the Constitution and different topics on, you know, Constitution and liberty.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I like that idea of using you know, these different entities to take the money out of your name, so you don't actually, it's not yours really, and they can't get it from you.
That's what he does for people. Yeah.
So, you know, that's pretty good, you know. And it's just what the big boys have been doing to us for years, you know. I knew a guy that used to have his wife carry a lien on his car and his tools and everything that he owned, so that if he got in trouble with his business, they had to pay the lien off before they can get any money out of his business to his wife. And like, he had this old beat up station wagon, and he had like an $8,000 lien on it. The car wasn't worth $8,000, but they went through, you know, they filed a debt on it. So If anybody came after them, they'd have to pay the liens that he had, that his wife was holding on him. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh yeah, that's probably more cost effective than paying for one of these common law trusts, actually.
Yeah, I don't know the ins and outs. I also took a seminar, you know, years ago. I used to go to this every summer. They call it the Good Life Get Together, and they had a bunch of people would come in and give classes and courses on, you know, natural living and this and that. And I was interested in mail order marketing, and there was some guy there, and I took a class for small business, and there was a guy in the back, and every time the teacher said do this, he goes, no, I wouldn't do that, I would do this. And he was frustrating her, and finally she says, well, who are you? And he said, well, I'm so and so. And he says, and I own 11 businesses, and I've been audited I forget how many times in the past 10 years, like, you know, and I haven't given them any money. I won every time. And so I ended up going to his tent because I wanted to hear what his stuff was. But one of the things that he did do, I mean, he understood, you know, business really well. I mean, he did other things, like he was selling blank pieces of wood that you turn on a lathe. So that was one of the things he was into, like making furniture, and he would sell blank woods that, you know, but anyway, he had like kind of factories and different things. He was into a lot of stuff, and he mail ordered marketed these cherry pieces of cherry and kind of oak and things to make that you could turn and make tables and lamps out of. But he said, I have 11 businesses, and one of them does nothing but rent all the equipment, the paper, the pens, the chairs, the computers, to the other businesses. So So the businesses didn't own anything. So if somebody came in and tried to get him and shut him down, it wasn't the business's stuff. The one business was in the business of renting all his other businesses, the equipment that they needed to run, which is an unbelievable idea that he thought of, you know. So he was pretty brilliant. And one of the other things he did, he came out with this ad, because back then there wasn't a lot of computer stuff. It was most of the stuff was done in specialty magazines and newspapers and things like that. And he was a mail order marketing expert. And he came up with this ad, and it had these colors. And it was a combination. I don't remember exactly what they were, but the ad would, like, jump out of the page at you. Well, he made more money patenting that ad that all the big advertising people bought from him to use, because it was that good. Everything he touched turned into gold. You know, I mean, it just so happened the ad was so good, and he thought, gee, that's good. I'm going to patent that, and he did. And so he even made money on the ads that he took out in the magazines to sell his wares. You know, talk about scraping every penny out of something. But anyway, I hope I help you. I mean, there's, you know, I give you some ideas anyway of what to pursue.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. And actually, on a similar topic, there was something today that General Flynn, Chase Bank, turned off all his credit cards and said he was a reputation risk.
Say that again. He does. So what is credit card?
Yeah, General Flynn.
Uh-huh.
So Chase, they show his, this is on Infowars.com, you can see a copy of the letter from Chase. We are closing all your credit card accounts because you're a reputational risk to Chase.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So I noticed on the same day or right after Alex Jones, he started collecting money now in Bitcoin on his website, and he's getting ready. He thinks they're going to try and kill him soon. Like, what do you call it? Like McAfee or something like that.
Right.
Or like they say.
You know who else died? I don't know if you know, but that Robert David Steele, the ex-Marine CIA guy that was running around doing the rejuvenation tour. He was touring. And he was getting people to do committees of safety, and the sheriff, Sheriff Mack, was running with him. They had a van. They were running all across the country. He's been doing it since, this early summer, spring. And he was someplace out west, and all of a sudden he gets sick. I mean, this guy has never been sick. He's like 67 years old, pretty robust. And they said he died of COVID. And then I went digging around to find out what, you know, and I finally did find an article where the guy claimed that, I guess, you know, I assume it was the camper that he was in. He had a nice camper that he was touring around the country. There were six or eight of them in it, that they put some kind of noxious stuff in the air system to make them all sick. And it must have caused some kind of lung inflammation, whatever it was a poison. And he went to the hospital probably to get oxygen, and they said, oh no, you have COVID. And so he wanted, he asked or demanded alternative treatment, like maybe intravenous vitamin C or hydroxychloroquine, whatever. And they refused him, and they put him on a ventilator. And the ventilator is a death sentence.
Yeah.
You know, when you have COVID, I mean, You're going on a ventilator. You're checking out. You know, you don't. Nobody gets off of them things. Virtually nobody. But anyway, it's a big loss for the nation. This guy was pretty good. John wanted him to interview him. We talked about him, Robert David Steele. So put him in your prayer.
I saw that he passed away. But I guess something similar happened to Scott McKay, and his dad passed away. Like, I guess the front two rows at one of these summer tours they were on, Patriot tours. Like,
oh,
they,
Scott they, McKay's they, dad passed away? I didn't know that.
It was the same kind of thing where they think someone sprayed the aerosolized spike proteins or something, some kind of bioweapon that's aerosolized to the front mm-hmm. two, the full front two rows of the audience got really violently ill.
I'm going to tell you something.
I was on a flight where something like that happened to me, and I wondered what was on that plane. But, yeah.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, you know, they sprayed the spike protein. They don't even know if there is a spike protein as far as that goes. What they're doing is they're poisoning you. COVID symptoms just so happen to mimic radiation symptoms, radiation poisoning. And it started in Wuhan, and they had the most COVID there. And what was the most heavily 5G-covered city in the world? It was in Wuhan. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so it was not a COVID virus. It was the fact that they had this high 5G that was burning their lungs or whatever. And when they want to poison you, that's what they do. They spray a poison. And they say, oh, it's a germ, it's this, it's that. No, they poison you. And what your body does is it grabs a hold of the poisons, the cells, and it puts it in a shell, and then you breathe it out. And when the scientists see these things coming out, they're called exosomes, they say that's the virus. So again, they're looking at the at the symptom instead of the cause. And they're identifying the symptom as the cause. You know, they're so backwards, you know.
I've read that too. I saw a video on that, and I read a Russian research paper where I guess they didn't want to adopt the 5G because they have a lot of research in Russia how it melts your, I guess, some internal structures in your body.
Oh, yeah, it's horrible, horrible stuff if it's around you, and they want to put it on every pole, and usually that's, you know, all these pandemics in the past, it turns out, if you go and you research, they were always introducing a new electronic thing like radar, sonar, television, you know, all these different things. And when they first came out, there was a percentage of the population that immediately was susceptible to that, you know, to those things, and they would get sick and die, and then they would call it a pandemic, the flu of 1918 and all this stuff. You go back and look at the electronics that they were throwing around back then, and that's what it was. So
yeah, I saw that. It was in the Vodafone video, the guy from Vodafone, the whistleblower. That's
right.
What he was talking about. But I wondered, too, if there's something they're not telling us, like if it blows out our internal cell structure, maybe that's why they're pumping graphene oxide into everyone through the vaccines. Maybe they know it's going to get blown out.
Well, they know. Look, they know a lot of stuff, and they don't, you know, they're evil, evil, evil. Anybody wants to get in the queue, you should, because there are only Rosses in there, and I will open them up in a minute here. And anyway, Amy, I'm going to move on. I guess you're done, right?
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Hey, Jan, did you have any more questions?
Yes, I have one more that we can take a look at here. All
okay.
I got to do is find it again.
Well, I could take Ross.
Well, here we go.
Okay, you got
this
it.
It says, an action at law is a case in law or equity per Amendment 10, and a proceeding in law and equity according to Article 3. That would be a federal subject matter jurisdiction. That means the enforcer or the service processor is a federal marshal, not a sheriff. And then says, see Article 3 of the Constitution. What you do is go into a federal court with a common law judgment to enforce. See 28 U.S.C. and 1738 and 39. The courts have told us that we must get that issue in front of the Supreme Court. We'll try this month. Any comments on that?
So that was more of a statement than a question.
It was a statement of what they think's going on.
Right. And it sounded pretty interesting, too.
Right.
that it sounds like good information.
We've been flagging the sheriff all the time. Maybe it's the marshal we need to be talking to.
Well, you know, I don't know that if that's totally true or not. I mean, look, you can get anybody to serve a person as long as they, you know, they're over 18. And, you know, we've had other people serve papers. It's not always the sheriff. Anybody can serve you, and as long as they swear to it and they identify you. And if you have two people as witnesses, that's even better. So I don't know why it has to be a marshal. That's a marshal would be somebody who would enforce an order from the court, is what I would think. Just like that's right. What the sheriff does, necessarily to subpoena them. You know what I'm saying?
He was saying that means the enforcer or the service processor is a federal marshal. In other words, if we're looking
at... Oh, for the service processor, right. So you could be the service processor.
Yeah.
But if they didn't answer it, then the marshal would come out and get them, is what the point is.
That's right. The enforcer should be the marshal.
Oh, so you can't go to the sheriff and tell him because he doesn't have jurisdiction because it's a federal issue.
Right.
Is that the point?
Yeah.
However, I do believe there's some kind of precedent or whatever that when the law is being broken, that like even a sheriff can enforce federal law in the state if it's a valid law. You know what I mean? If it's valid and it's constitutional, I think that he can still arrest him on a federal charge. I don't think you need a fed to arrest him. I think a sheriff can arrest him on a federal charge if he knows that they're violating it, and then he can hold them for the feds. I've heard of that. I don't know. Do you think that they worry about who they get to arrest us when you owe the IRS? You know what I mean? Well, they're not going to get the state police to come and get you. You know what I'm saying?
Well, no, this means when we file something and they ignore it. Maybe
right. That we should, I understand. That we should go to the. I'm just making a conversation point that we should go to, but I'm saying there's probably. I don't know that a sheriff can't enforce that, you know.
Right.
You know, especially if you look at your state constitution. Somebody was telling me this today, like New York's constitution has a lot of good stuff in it, you know, that you can enforce. Now, if that runs parallel with the federal law, you know what I mean? Sometimes they have laws that are similar that fall under the same type of thing. That would even give the sheriff more clout to enforce that or, you know, to detain somebody and make them show up at court or whatever. I don't know. It's interesting. We should look into it. But if you know who the enforcer is and you go to them, then there's no question, right?
Right.
So then that's what we would do, I would say. But anyway, I guess he'll let us know how he makes out with that.
I hope so.
Yeah, and maybe, and if it works, we should print that out so people can follow it, because I certainly won't remember all that.
Right.
You know?
I'll keep a record.
Yeah, but interesting stuff. Okay, that was easy because I didn't have to really answer anything. I made a lot of conversation that wasn't, you know, just playing the devil's advocate there. So the next person in the queue, Ross, has been in there a while. I'm going to open Ross up. Go ahead, Ross. You are unmuted.
How can I reverse my claim of the 10th Amendment to do the petition to congress.com or whatever?
Say that again. I didn't quite get it. How can you reverse the 10th Amendment? What?
Claim. I mean,
you have a 10th Amendment claim?
Yes, to Congress itself.
Okay.
I sent it through petition to Congress website.
You sent it to the petition to Congress website?
Yes.
And you have a 10th Amendment claim. I don't know what to answer you that. I'm not familiar with that. And I mean, they actually have a website that says that you can file that there, and you did file it there?
Yeah,
did they answer you?
Oh, I did get an answer from Orr Blumenthal for the 3rd Congressional District of Oregon.
You got an answer, and what did he say? We don't handle this stuff.
He said he has received thousands and thousands of emails and texts every day. He will respond to give me more details.
Well, so he didn't respond. He just responded that he got your thing, and he wants you to get more details. Yeah.
I think he... You know, he said he was going to give details to me.
Oh.
About the petition. I don't know if I read that correctly. I will respond to you in more detail as soon as I can.
Oh, so he's going to respond to you as soon as he can, but he's not telling you, not giving you any data when he's going to respond. So it sounds to me like you sent it to the right place.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and so maybe he doesn't know what to answer you, but he's stalling, I don't know, or maybe he is really busy, I don't know. You know, they're always busy messing with us, so. But
and
it sounds...
I also sent it to Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley. These are my two senators for your Senate.
Now,
they haven't responded at all.
And this is a petition. I mean, it's not an action at law. It's a petition. It's a 10th Amendment claim.
Yes.
But they don't have unlimited time to answer you. They got to answer under the confines of the federal rules of procedure, I would imagine. Just like you got to respond by a certain time, I would think that they would have some kind of rules of procedure
It's the rules of Congress. For the petition process in Congress itself, they have rules for that.
So did you read the... Do you know those rules? Have you seen them?
Yes, because, I have. Sadly.
Okay, so you know more about this than I do, then, basically. And what do they give a... Do they give a time frame of when they have to answer these things?
I don't know. I think one time I said, what is the rules of petitioning Congress or whatever? Because the House of Representatives have rules, a representative have to submit in a certain amount of time.
Well, I mean... There has to be a procedure if they go over time that you can, or you have some redress. And I don't know what that is. I mean, you have to read through those and see if they spell it out, or they're just, you know, hiding it in flowery language. And I don't want to give you too much information, maybe.
They probably really do hide it in flowery language. I read it. I don't really see it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Language to...
See, that's why these lawyers that go in federal court get extra money, because it's a little different than regular court. You know what I mean? The rules of procedure and all that. And if you don't know, they're not going to tell you. You know what I mean? Although, if you ask a direct question, they should give you a direct answer. You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes it's how you ask the question, how the answer that you get. Oh, they want to give legal advice. I'm not asking legal advice. I want to know. I need to know the procedure that you require on this paper. You know what I mean? I don't consider that legal advice. You know, we're talking about putting it in.
Yes, because this is a message to Congress. It's not any, like, court procedure for that at all.
Right, right. It's just, it's a message to them.
Yes, it's a petition.
And so they're going to acknowledge that they got it, and if it's a message of something that they that you're telling them that they have a certain responsibility to do and they're not doing it, then what? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, what you're doing is you're documenting that you petitioned Congress for this or this or that. And the thing is then it's in public, and it's kind of an embarrassment if they don't fix it. If you, I don't know what claims you made, but whatever it is, you know, they have a duty to, you know, to act, to, especially when you bring it to light like that. I don't know what the teeth are to make them act, though. I mean, basically,
okay.
You're...
Yes, it's called Declaring Individual Sovereignty Petition.
Uh-huh.
And that petition talks about the 10th Amendment.
Right. I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with all this stuff, but I'm kind of going off what you tell me. It sounds like you got to read that and have really good reading comprehension. You know, I mean, you already did file something with them. They have it. Now, the question is, you know, is there another step you could take beyond that? Sounds like you did a pretty good job with what you did do, you know?
Yes. And, my parents think I didn't comprehend what that really meant.
Sounds to me like you got some even better comprehension of it than I do, because I'm not familiar with what petitioning Congress or anything like that. I have no idea. Even us at NLA, we've never done that. You know what I mean?
You have done the court system. That's totally different process there.
Right, right. So, you know.
Dealing with lawyers and the judge process.
Right.
That's a whole different thing.
No, I know. And, I know. And, so, and you know, like I said, when you're petitioning Congress, basically you're petitioning them and you're doing it in public so that it's a part of the public record. But I don't know if they got anything over there that they put in that will actually allow you to slap their hands. I mean, basically, they would be embarrassed. No. The whole thing is that once you petition something, and if it's valid, and they don't do something, it's an embarrassment for them. I guess, you know, it doesn't. It won't look good on their record when it comes time to run for re-election. Whoever these guys are, you know. I think I got a note.
You guys should put that information on National Labor Alliance for petitioning Congress. And
You know what? I don't know what you used or what form you used, but whatever you used, you should send it to us so that we can.
Actually, I used it on the House of Representatives website. They have that information on their website.
Okay. So we'll have to look that up and see. We've never, like I said, this is new subject matter to me, you know?
That's a good thing. I give you guys notice about
gave
that.
Us a, you gave us a good nugget, huh?
Yes, I did.
Okay, well, thank you, Ross.
I do a lot of research. Do a lot of research, that's why.
I can tell. I can tell.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you for that information, Ross. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Okay, Brent is here, and we're gonna turn him loose. But I wanna ask him about this doctrine of the lesser magistrate, if he's familiar with that. That's kind of something I went over while you weren't here, there was a couple of articles that I ran across today, and I ran a little tape of this pastor talking about Romans 13 and how it doesn't mean that you just obey the civil authorities, that it absolutely does not mean that. And he gave plenty of biblical examples of you know, people that were, you know, like John and certain people that in the Bible that disobeyed the civil authorities when they were wrong, when they told them they couldn't pray, or they told them to do that, and they absolutely did not just obey the civil authority. And anyway, he has a book out on Amazon called The Doctrine, that you can buy, The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates, A Proper Resistance to Tyranny and a Repudiation of Unlimited Obedience to Civil Government. Because I have read that the federal government is sending the churches this stuff, you know, and they're quoting Romans 13, telling the churches that they should preach to the people, that they need to kowtow to the officials, like the social distancing and the mass things, and that these priests and these pastors should be preaching that, and it's totally, totally wrong. So I don't know if you want to expound more upon that or not, but that was part of the subject, Brent. Are you there?
Yeah.
You
got me now, Gerard?
I do. I do hear you.
Gerard?
Yeah. So I don't know what you had planned.
No, the Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrate. Mm-hmm. No, I'm glad you brought it up. Matt Truella is the one that is known for talking about that, and I traveled with Matt all throughout the state of Alaska, and that's a lot of territory to cover. And they asked me, I was there, and we invited him up. I was there at the time, and been just 3 years, 4 years ago or something.
So you actually met Matt Truella.
They asked, pardon?
So you've met Matt Truella, the author of the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I traveled probably 2,500 miles with him, or 2,000.
No, see, I knew it was a good thing for me to ask you that.
Traveling in a pickup.
I just ran his video there before. But go ahead, I'll shut up and let you go.
Yeah, okay. I hope you can hear me. I feel like...
No, I can. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sitting... Okay. I'm sitting on a bench in a little town out in the Rocky Mountains. But at any rate, Matt is a pastor of the church up in Wisconsin. He grew up somewhere up there, and we call it Cheesehead Land, and he one of those cities. And he spent his teenage years stealing hubcaps off cars, stuff like that. Ended up going to reform school. A typical American story. But at any rate, now he pastors a church up there, and he's a peach of a fellow. He made a name for himself because he'd been arrested several times protesting in front of abortion mills. And one of the things I like about Matt, he says, I'm tired of pieces of paper. People are always going to have another piece of legislation or another city ordinance, and he says, nothing's changing. We just have to stop the murder. But that's just one of the things he does. But, of course, the doctor, the lesser magistrate, he came on to that when I was – they asked me if I'd introduce him where we went. And that was my job. So I said, well, I need to understand what this is all about. So I read his little book that you had just mentioned. By the way, you can go to the Amazon or the Internet someplace and type in Matt Truella, T-R-E-W-E-L-L-A, I believe. Matt Truella. It's a Welsh name, I think. No, it's Cornish. I have one of those two. Anyway, he was telling me about kind of a funny name. But type it in. You can get the book, but it's just simple. It's nothing fancy. Back in the old days in Europe and up in, I think the name of the place is Martinburg, and I remember that place because one of my relatives was shot out of an airplane over there and was taken prisoner in that little part of the world. But a long time ago, during the Reformation, these magistrates said, you got to stop this madness and this murder. Magistrate, that means a fellow that's not at the very top of the political chain. He's down in the middle. And instead of obeying orders, he says, no, that's the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. For example, this clerk down in Kentucky, she was a clerk of the county, elected official. And she said, I'm not going to issue marriage license for sodomites. I'm not going to do that. So the governor ordered to do it. Everybody else ordered it. The Supreme Court, whoever. And I'm not going to do it. Well, then, of course, a lawsuit, and she was facing jail, all those kind of things. That's the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. She wasn't the governor. She wasn't the vice governor. She wasn't the president. She wasn't the Supreme Court justice. She was just a lesser magistrate, a lowly official, and said, I ain't going to do that. And that's what America's all about, because nobody in government in America has the final word on anything. That's the way it's supposed to work. And that's why everybody takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution. As Andy Jackson said, I didn't take an oath to support and defend the Constitution as somebody else understands it. I took an oath to defend it as only I could understand it. Is there any other way to take an oath? Absolutely not. There isn't any other way. So that's what the doctrine of the lesser magistrate is. And when I introduced him, I thought, well, what can demonstrate this? See, the doctrine of the lesser magistrate is sometimes called interposition. That means that one person who's not a high-ranking government official imposes himself between a high-ranking government official and one of the freemen of the United States. You got, say you're, the government's after you. Here, I've had this experience. The government bust into an office building without a warrant, and I happen to be present when this happened once. And somebody there says, I'm calling the sheriff over here to see if these federal agents are doing the right thing. They haven't got a warrant. I'm calling the sheriff. And the sheriff comes over, and he interposes himself. That's called the doctrine of interposition. Inter, that means between. Poses, that means to pose yourself, to stand between an evil government and somebody that's being abused. That's what the sheriff is supposed to do. He's supposed to be the interposer, the doctrine of interposition. And I illustrated it this way. It made a good point to me. I suppose other people get it too. But there was back during the early days of the Reformation in Scotland, there was a Roman priest there by the name of John Knox. John Knox. And John Knox finally got the idea that the Bible had more authority than Rome. And so he took up with it. Now, he was a highly educated man. As all Roman priests, they are lawyers of the law of the city. That they're highly trained, and he was too. He'd been educated on the continent of Europe. But he became as a little baby, as the Bible says, and he understood the fundamentals of what it means to have salvation. And so he knew a fellow there who was a street preacher. They would let preachers preach the Bible in the churches, and this fellow's name was Wishard, George Wishard. And George used to go out and preach out in the fields and whatnot. Of course, they were always trying to arrest him. Well, the crowds were trying to kill George Wishard. When he'd stand up to preach and present the gospel, the crowds would throw brick bats at him. They didn't throw bouquets. They threw brick bats. And so John Knox, well, let me tell you how here's the way I introduced Matt. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet, eating her curds and whey. Long came a spider and sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away. Now, Miss Muffet was a real person, and she was the stepdaughter of a fellow named Dr. Muffet in Scotland. Dr. Muffet. And Dr. Muffet was an insectologist back over we're talking back in the 1500s. He was studying bugs. He was a bug studier with a doctor's degree. And his name was Dr. Muffet, and he had a stepdaughter named, he called her Miss Muffet, who's his term of affection for her. And she went over and sat on her tuffet. And she had little tuffets, a little milking stool that they'd take for little children. Somebody would put a little skirt around it, make it look cute, and a little girl would go over there and sit, and they gave her curds and whey. That means cottage cheese. That's what curds and whey is, cottage cheese. Gave it to her, and she went over there. But one of Dr. Muffet's specimens had got loose, and it happened to be a spider. And I know somebody's saying, but a spider is not an insect. Well, yeah, that's true, but in those days, they didn't make such distinctions. But this spider got loose, and little Miss Muffet was over there sitting on her tuffet, eating her cottage cheese, and she saw the spider, and it frightened her, and she ran away. And so Dr. Muffet, he noticed an analogy there. And when he wrote that, he didn't write that about his daughter. He was making a point about John Knox and Mary, Queen of Scots. See, John Knox's his nickname was the Spider. They called him the Spider. And the reason they called him the Spider was because he was a galoot. He was a galoot. That means that when he walked, his knuckles drug on the ground and his fingers were exceedingly long. I'm exaggerating a little, but not much. But John Knox was long-boned and long-fingered, and his hands looked like spiders, and so his nickname was the Spider. But because he had such long arms, he became the bodyguard for George Wishard when he preached. He'd stand in front of George Wishard, between George Wishard and the people that were trying to throw brickbats and whatnot at George. He didn't just stand there. He stood there with what a long-armed man can be very effective with, namely a claymore. Claymore. And a claymore is one of those big broadswords that he used to make split personalities with. That's the kind of a sword that William Wallace carried, was a claymore. Great big two-handed sword. Well, John Knox had one of these. The Scots word for a big sword is claymore. Claymore means big sword in Scots, braid Scots language, the English of the Scots. And he carried this thing, and he stood between the hostile crowd and George Wishart with his claymore. He interposed himself between the crowd and George, and he was his bodyguard. That's called interposition, to stand between a hostile crowd or one hostile man and another fellow that needs protection. And when we called the sheriff in to be there when the Fed showed up, that means that we called the sheriff in to interpose himself. That's called the doctrine of interposition. The lesser magistrate, he's from the state government, he's from the county government, so as a matter of being a big shot with a lot of power, he has a lot of power within his county, but he's not an IRS agent, he's not a federal agent, but the doctrine of the lesser magistrate is the doctrine of interposition. Those are all fancy Latin words, because the people that first wrote about it in Latin, because it was during the Reformation in Germany at a place called Magdeburg, and the city fathers there said, no, we're not gonna go along with this, and we're not gonna help the central government promote the ideas and force the behavior that they want to force. See, if these governors in the states right now would do their job of the lesser magistrate, lesser than the president, not having as much power as the president, when the president said something, they just say, if it's not constitutional, they just say no. You guys can do what you want to do. Just go on. But no, not here. Not me. No, I'm not going there. I'm not going to do what's unlawful. But we see what we call today political correctness. People are afraid not to go along with the crowd. The sheriffs, often, the governors, the secretary of states. I'm familiar with what's going on in Michigan because I have friends up there. And there's a trinity they call the Unholy Trinity. The governor, the secretary of state, and some other, what is that other? Oh, maybe it's the vice governor, I don't know. But three Jezebels up there. Three Jezebels. And if you don't know who Jezebel is, go look her up. Quite a story about Jezebel. And it's illustrative of what goes on constantly in this evil, twisted world. There are a lot of Jezebels out there, and a lot of men that follow them. That's what we got going. But the doctrine of the lesser magistrate says, like Sheriff Darleaf has been on here with us on this, on NLA, and spoken before, Sheriff Darleaf has said to the governor, well, you guys can do what you're going to do. We're not going to promote that here, and I'm not going to enforce that. The sheriff in Elko, Nevada apparently has said the same thing. You fellows can do what you want in the rest of the state, but I'm not enforcing it. These laws are unconstitutional, and I took an oath. I swore, I said I wouldn't do that. And by the way, I want to throw something else in here, drop a footnote, as it were. The Bible's clear as crystal. If you take an oath, God will require it of you. If you take an oath, God will require it of you. This is no small matter, friends, neighbors, and kin. Don't be swearing indiscriminately and taking oaths just any old way. Think about what you're doing, draw it down tight if you've got to do it. But you better follow through with it, because if you don't, God's going to force it on you, and it won't be pleasant. He'll get what he wants out of you. Be careful what comes out of your lips. And all these officers that are doing this, an oath doesn't amount to a pinch of dried almond to most people anymore. They don't even, if you ask them to define what it was, they couldn't even clearly do it. But they'll take the oath just to get into office. They think it's a joke, I suppose. No, this is a big deal. Swearing falsely is a big deal, because what you're doing is you're calling God into witness, to witness what you promised and you've supported with an oath, and you're asking God, the greater power, to come in and make you perform in case you falter. Nothing wrong with doing that, but just be careful when you do it. You don't do it flippantly and bite off too much. Now, the other thing that Gerard mentions, Romans chapter 13, and I'm old enough now, I just say to people, of course, I know I don't know everything. Let's state the obvious up front. I don't know everything, obviously. But I have said a lot about Romans 13, and if you get the winterized version of the Bible, you'll get the translation of Romans 13 and all the footnotes. I've probably got more footnotes on Romans 13 than any other part of the Bible. But Romans 13 doesn't say anywhere that men are to obey a government no matter what. As a matter of fact, Romans 13, the popular version, of course, is the King James version. And King James, of course, he wanted that version translated to promote himself. All government projects are that way. I mean, let's get real. He wasn't going to take tax money and not promote himself, and he did. He promoted himself as a one-man government in that translation. That doesn't mean there's not good things you can't get out of it. You can also get the gospel out of it. There, it's all there. But when it comes to passages like Romans 13, he twisted that. He had his translators twist that, and he did it under a very specific policy. If you didn't believe in the divine right of kings, he wouldn't even let you on the translation team. There were 54 men on that team, and every one of them swore to support him that he was the final word on everything. He was God walking on earth. That's what they did. Well, that version of the Bible, it's a beautiful piece of literature. I don't hesitate to say it. It's the most beautiful piece of literature in the English tongue. It was done at a time when English was at its zenith of development. Beautiful it is. I like to read it. But there's a lot in it that's dangerous. And Romans 13 is one of those. As a matter of fact, King James I adds to Romans 13 twice the word power. It's not in the Greek text anywhere. Twice. And he translates power when he should be translating authority. I say him, well, his team of translators. The word power is not in Romans 13 anywhere. The powers that be, as William Tyndale had translated before. No, it's the word that means authority, jurisdiction, warrant. Right is the old Anglo word. It says there is no authority except from God. Well, the King James and some other translators, some say there is no power except from God. Well, that's quite a difference between power and authority. Joe Biden has power. So did Obama. He had a lot of power. But did he have authority? He had absolutely none because he wasn't president of the United States. He wasn't a natural-born citizen. Both of his parents weren't citizens when he was born. That's a key element that people don't talk about. He wasn't. So he had no authority. But did he have power? You bet he did. Did he wield it? Oh, boy, did he wield it. Same way with Joe Biden. Does he have authority? No, he has none. He has no authority. Why? Because he didn't win the election. He didn't win according to due process. He didn't win according to the process our Constitution demands. Does he have authority? None. Does he have jurisdiction? None. Does he have power? You better believe it. People are doing what he says. Well, that's what Romans 13 talks about, and that's the distinction it makes. It doesn't talk about power. It talks about authority, jurisdiction. What is jurisdiction? Jurisdiction is the right to act respecting a given matter. Jurisdiction is the right to act respecting a given matter. And that passage there in Romans 13 says that we are to obey all, watch this, authority. All authority. Why? Because there is no authority except delegated from God. That's what he says. God is the spring, the source, the fountain of all authority. He doesn't say he's the fountain of all power, is he? Yeah, he is, but that's not what it's talking about there. It's talking about authority. Let's translate it this way. In the French translation, for instance, says that there is no authoritia. Authoritia, that's the French word. I'm probably not pronouncing it right, but that's the French word. Maybe it's a little unusual, but the French got that one right. And the English translations are getting it wrong. It is authority. It is the right to act. God delegates that right to men. We live in the day of man's government because God has delegated to man the authority to govern, to hold courts right now. The day is coming when we call the day of the Lord. This is the day of man, according to Apostle Paul. The day of man, but there's a day of the Lord the Bible talks about. And when that happens, Jesus Christ will rule. All three branches of government will be in him. All power, too, by the way. been, not right now, though. He has seen fit, for whatever reason, to delegate that government to us. And we better be doing it. If you're not doing it the way God says to do it, well, when the judgment comes, you may be in the wrong place. Don't do that. Make sure you know. But to start, it's important to understand that all authority, yes, all authority is from the Maker of all things. And by the way, if all authority is from Him, and He delegates it, it is unlawful to disobey authority in every case. It is, of course, the right thing to do to disobey power that's outside of authority. But if it's authority, I mean, it's really, there's no such thing, friends, neighbors, and kin, there is no such thing as false authority. You either have it or you don't. I mean, that's like saying there's such a thing as false pregnancy. Either you're pregnant or you ain't. And is there false authority? No. There is what the common law calls, you learn about this stuff in law school, apparent authority. Apparent authority. Is apparent authority authority? No, it just looks like it is. I walk into a bank and the janitor's there sweeping up behind the counter. And he sees me walk up. I walk up to the counter. And he kind of lays the broom down and says, can I help you? And I say, yeah, I'd like to make a deposit. And I give him $10,000 and he takes it and he acts like he's the clerk there and he puts it over here and he writes me out a receipt, does all the paperwork because he's seen it done, and he gives it to me. He takes the money and he pockets it in his pocket. Did he have authority to do that? No, he didn't. Did he have apparent authority in my eyes? Yeah, I thought he was the clerk of the bank. See, now that particular story I just told you, that's a real case that really happened. pretty sharp janitor picking up how to make some money. But he finally got sued, and the court said, well, that was apparent authority, but it wasn't authority. Well, that's the way it is with a lot of Joe Biden and a lot of these cops and mayors. They're claiming authority. That's called a false flag. They're flying the flag that says, I have authority. But it's a false flag. They don't have any authority for what they're doing. Now, one more point I'll make, and then I'll sum up and quit. But authority is distinguished from power. Authority, the Bible distinguishes authority from power, and it does it in Romans chapter 13. We are bound, let me say it again, we are bound to obey all authority. Why? Because if it's true authority, you better obey it. But all power, that's different. Now, I do like William Tyndale's translation of Romans 13. He calls it the powers that be. The powers that be? He didn't say government. Of course he doesn't say government. The word government's not in that passage. It's just the word authority, the Greek word, exousia. It means authority. It doesn't mean power. Out of being. It's what comes. It's there are a lot of people that have authority. Nobody pays any attention to them, on the other hand. For example, fathers in our own day, fathers. Nobody pays attention to the authority of a father much anymore. I mean, there are exceptions. Does a father have authority? You better believe he has authority. God gave it to him. All authority is from God, and God gives authority to fathers. The governments deny that, strip people of power. Do we have authority direct from God? He's the source of all authority. Yeah, John chapter 1, verse 12. To as many as received him, to them gave he what? Well, the translations say power to become sons of God. Well, what's the word? Exousia, authority. Authority, the right. The right to act respecting a given matter. Authority. Jurisdiction is the same meaning but stresses the scope of authority. And no man, of course, has unlimited authority. God does, but we don't. All of our authority is limited. We're given a certain amount, but God gives it to us. So, to sum up, the doctrine of the lesser magistrate just says that there are magistrates. Magistrates, that's a big fancy word that means officers in government, like the sheriff. And sheriff can interpose himself. That's the doctrine of interposition. Position himself, inter. That's Latin for between. Oh, I hate Latin words. All they do is sound fancy and impressive, but nobody knows what they mean. Interposition means, inter means between, and position means to position yourself. To position yourself between a fellow that's being abused than the government. I mean, even our common law says that's what we have a duty to do. Defense of third parties. Somebody's getting beat up on the streets. What if you see a cop? A cop, I saw a video on YouTube not too long ago of a cop knocking somebody out of a wheelchair and kicking the stuffings out of it. Now, is that lawful? No, he had no authority to do that. Well, did he have the power to do it? Well, you better believe he had the power to do it, and he was doing it. Oh, here's an interesting question. If I see that happening on the street, what is my duty? What should I stop him? What if I pull a pistol and say, you either stop kicking him, I'm going to put a hole through you big enough to paddle a canoe through with this big bore pistol I got here. Is that what I should do? Those are important questions. At what point do men say no to government? You're exercising power without authority. You've stepped out of the scope of your jurisdiction. You have no jurisdiction to kick the daylights out of a man in a wheelchair. Just as one example, it happens a lot. It's called police abuse. It's always been around. It's been around in our country. It's still here. It's getting a little worse now. But if you said to a police officer no and stood between him and the person he was abusing, you'd probably end up going to jail. You might get shot. You might get hurt. Bad. But that would be interposition. I'm not encouraging people to do that because you got to think about your responsibilities. You could get thrown in jail for a long time. You could get hurt. You could get fined. You could, they could do permanent damage. I remember Matt Truella telling me about, and this is something that really upset him, and I know about this particular situation as I've been to this church out in Southern California, Grace Community Church of the Valley on Roscoe Boulevard in the San Fernando Valley. It's still there. The pastor there is a well-known man named John MacArthur, Johnny Mac, his friends call him. And I was there when he was a very young man. I haven't been there in years. I'm just saying I know where it is. And one of the elders in that church for years, his name is Bob Vernon, and he was assistant chief of police there in Los Angeles, city of Los Angeles, Bob Vernon, a graduate of Biola College. And he was a staunch Christian man. Well, Matt was telling me the story that people were protesting the abortion mills or standing outside or sitting outside. Well, he had to make a decision what to do about it. Bob Vernon did. He was assistant chief of police. And so, being a Christian man and in recognizing the persuasive force of the church, and he was a part of the church, an elder, he consulted the elders and consulted MacArthur. Back then, John MacArthur's attitude was, you pay your taxes, you do what the government tells you, and I've heard him teach it. And he said, well, I'd say arrest him and drag him off to jail. That's what he told Bob Vernon to do. Well, so Bob Vernon tells the police officers, yeah, arrest him, take him off to jail. The protesters protesting the abortion mills. I think you can go to YouTube and find this stuff, but what they ended up doing was breaking a lot of arms. I mean, snapping them like toothpicks. You can hear them pop. That's what happens with power. See, government has no tool but force. They have no other tool to get what the will of government outside of force and threat of force. Force and threat of force. That's why in America for years, we're talking first 50, 60 years of our existence, nobody in America would have thought allowing a police officer to carry a gun. That was unthinkable. Why? Because people with guns are crazy like that. No, I'm not talking about citizens with guns. They can be. Guns are dangerous, of course, but you give those to police officers, they get to feeling their power. They get to using their force. They like to. They're nothing at this point. Across the board, it seems that policemen are nothing but thumpers, jackbooted thugs. You say, well, I know some that aren't. I'm one myself. I'm not that way. Well, good for you. But you're living in that world. And the burden's on you to prove you ain't, because everybody else is. I'm not blind. I've lived long enough to see what policemen are. Are there bad men out there? Oh, yeah. But I'd rather live with bad men, a little bit of bad men, and have the policeman err on the side of freedom than to err on the other side and jail a whole lot of people that are innocent, and that's what we have now. Well, that's called the doctrine of interposition. And we look, not primarily to ourselves, to interpose ourselves, though. That way. We look to our officers in government to do that. Why? Because it's good order. If I try to interpose myself between the government and people they're abusing, well, that might be a fool's errand in a lot of cases. Like I tell my clients, they want to do this, that, and the other and stop them physically and get the militia up and start shooting people. And I said, now remember, these guys you're wanting to fight are the guys that have the United States Marine Corps and aircraft carriers. you better be calculating when you go to war whether or not you can win. Yeah, that's the thing. So it is good if we can get sheriffs. This is what we're talking about. A lesser magistrate in a smaller jurisdiction, such as the county, to just say no. Okay, I'm going to end by saying, please join us. Please join us in our sheriff's course beginning the 9th of this month. Sheriff Darleaf is, I'm hoping he takes a big part. He knows a lot. He's in his fifth term, crying out loud. Go to thecommonlawyer.com and you can sign up for the course. And we look forward to seeing you there. Thank you, Gerard. This was timely. No, this was the thing that we need to talk about. In Romans 13, we need to talk about Romans 13. I'll tell you, if I could give everybody an assignment, and I'll do it too. I need to go back and just read Romans 13 again. But if you read it in the King James, recognize that King James used that translation to promote his power. The pilgrims that came to America wouldn't even bring the King James Bible. And they didn't. They hated it. For that reason, they brought the Geneva Bible with them. And it's all right that King James Bible, it's a beautiful Bible, but I'm just making the point. It's important to know why people have made Bible translations. It helps you understand how to read it. But go read Romans 13. Read it in the New American Standard. Read it in the King James. Keep in mind what the King James policy is. And think about Romans 13 in the terms I've told you. We're not talking about powers that be, like William Tyndale translated. Fiction, warrant, Anglo-Saxon word, right. Back to you, Gerard. Thank you. That was really an important point you brought up, and I'm glad you mentioned Romans 13.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. That was just dumb luck. I stumbled across that today, and I figured I'd throw it in your pen there.
Matt Truell is all over YouTube too.
We played his little speech today. Tonight.
Oh, okay.
And he said a lot.
Which one was it, Gerard?
It was a tape here where he was being interviewed. Let me see by.
Health Ring.
The New American, I think. It was a Rumble video. The New American.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't play the whole thing. It's 24 minutes long, but I played, you know, the beginning of it anyway, where, you know, enough to, everybody got the idea, you know. So, you know, I just ran across it today.
Matt's got a YouTube video up. I've seen it, and it's about how he's feeding. He's got a bunch of chickens, he used to, and he's feeding his chickens and how fat they're getting and how much they like him and how he fattens them up and keeps them healthy. And then the day comes when it's time to slaughter the chickens. And the chickens didn't know that's why he was feeding them. It's picturesque, to say the least, about what the evil empire is doing to us, fattening us up, giving things to us, and just waiting to enslave. Kill us.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you, Gerard. I'll let you get back to it. Thanks for waiting for me, too.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Okay. We got a couple of people in the queue still. So I'll go down the top. It looks like Terry's next. Go ahead, Terry. You've been unmuted.
Yes, sir. I don't know if it's a really question. I just want to say that over 90% of your churches are 501c3, which is actually, they don't even need to be. And because the Constitution says that they are automatically exempt from taxation, the First Amendment. But they run off the IRS to get tax exempt, and by doing that, they're under government powers. Okay. That's the thing that's why a lot of churches aren't doing anything. Because if they would come against the government, like if they would actually speak out against homosexuality, lesbianism, and all that stuff, the government would come down hard because they're actually under government control.
Yeah.
should get out of 501c3. You can blame Johnson for that one in 1957. He's the one that introduced the legislature when he was a senator from Texas. So a lot, as I said, a lot of people, you know, they go by the 13th Amendment or the 13th Romans 13. We're talking about you know, you have to abide by the government power. Well, technically, if you're 501c3, you do. You know, because you have to give them consent. And by going to them to be tax exempt, you already give it to you free. You know, you're supposed to be tax exempt anyway because you're a church. By giving them consent, you give them power over you. And that's one of the biggest problems they have in the churches. That's like, well, they don't do anything. They can't.
Well, they're told not to. You'll lose your tax exempt status.
There you go. That's it.
You lose your tax exempt. And you know, the churches knew that they were tax exempt, but what the federal government did is they put a little carrot on the stick.
There you go.
And they said, well, your parishioners will be able to write off what they give you. See, so it was a bone to the people too, but. And then what you have is certain people that use that, give that to lower their tax bracket. In other words, it pays for them to give to the church because of the deduction that they get, and they save on the other end. And so if you didn't have the 501(c), if I gave money to my church, I wouldn't be able to write it off my income tax, technically.
Well, yeah.
So that was the bone that they threw them. That the pastors all went, yeah, okay. So that's how they got them. I remember when Trump first came in, there was talk that he was going to get rid of that Johnson Amendment, which said that they're not allowed to preach from the pulpit or anything like that. I mean, you know, one of the things that was big in this country at the time, there was the French philosopher Tocqueville, and he said, look at the power of America was not its, you know, ports and its amber waves of grain and all this. He said the power of this country was in the pulpits. They were on fire with the word of God and government under God. And that's what we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. And I agree. Yeah. 501(c) is a bad thing, and they don't need it, and they're all afraid to get out of it.
Well, I know Tex Mars, years ago, he was 501(c)(3). And he was preaching, of course, against a lot of things that are happening in the world today. But he passed away by, I think, 2019. But the IRS audited him. And so after the audit, he got out of 501(c)(3), changed his name. They changed the name of the ministry. And he's better off for doing that, which is a great thing. And all churches should get out of 501(c)(3) as best as they can. And, you know, I mean, the Apostle Paul is a tent maker. You know, you might have to do that, or maybe be a carpenter or something like that, to raise money for a church. Besides, you see, God doesn't want you to be the church. He doesn't want you to go to church. He wants you to be the church. That's important. And just like Yahweh doesn't want your worship, he wants your friendship. You don't understand that concept. Mm-hmm. And so, churches to get out of that, but since so many of them are still 501(c)(3). They're under the government auspices. So they can't preach against homosexuality, lesbianism, transgenders, and all that stuff. At least not effectively. They could try, but then they probably get shut down. And there have been pastors that have been shut down for preaching this sort of stuff. That's just the thing I wanted to mention, that if any pastor is listening, try to do your best to get out of 501(c)(3) and be independent. There's a little church in Union, Kentucky that's independent, which is great, a small church. But the Bible doesn't even say church, it says community. So we have to realize that, I think it was King James that came up with the church. But we got to realize that we're a community of believers, and we're not to be under any government rules, regulations. In fact, the founding fathers, Washington and Jefferson, they, I don't think they even got a salary per se. I think that they got certain stipends from the churches. That's what they did. So I just think that it's very important that churches get out of 501(c)(3), get out of the government offices, and be able to be more independent.
Well, they're serving two masters. That whole thing about a man can't serve two masters, there you go, right there.
Well, yeah, they don't fear God anymore. And that's unfortunate because God's going to put the hammer down on them.
Yeah.
Just like Jesus Christ told Peter, "Do you love me?" And I had a small vision where I actually saw that. And the third time Jesus Christ asked Peter if he loved him, and Peter was angry because Jesus Christ asked him three times. Well, that's not why he was angry. It's because when Jesus Christ asked him the third time, he slapped Peter in the face, not hard. He slapped him to get his attention. And that's why Peter was angry. See, so that's what I think Yahweh is trying to tell us right now. He's kind of slapping us around to try to tell us, either you're going to be with me or against me. Like the Laodiceans in church. Same thing. You're with them or against them. You don't want to be in the middle. See, if you're in the middle, God's going to consider you that you're an enemy. And that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah. So, there was something else there. Lost my train of thought on the... There's another name that they can apply for. It's a 70-something, and it's the automatic exemption that you were talking about.
Uh-huh.
There is a number, and they need to apply under that number, and they need to say, which makes them sovereign, so to speak, that they get the exemption under the Constitution.
Because you see, when you get involved in the government, you get involved with a lot of policies and procedures. Some people say there's three sides of the Constitution. One's the government, one's the commerce, and one, I think one's the judiciary. Now, Congress supposedly hasn't been in session since 1860, supposedly. That's what I've been told. But we are under the commerce side of the Constitution. The Constitution isn't dead, per se. It's just that most of it, the real Constitution, is like kind of laying in dormant because they found out that it makes more money to go commercial than to go to government, because governed by the people, which means that the governed people, well, like your governors, all they are supposed to be administrators.
Right.
Governors cannot really tell you that you have to wear a mask. They can't tell you that legally. And a lot of these stores that have these policies, we have to wear a mask, that's policy. And again, I can go to Rodriguez versus Ray Donovan, Department of Labor, 769 F2D 1344-1348, 1985, where the Supreme Court actually said that all codes, rules, regulations, policies are for government officials only. They're not intended for creation of human/creation under God's laws. All codes, rules, regulations, and policies are unconstitutional and lack due process. So, a lot of the policies, it's actually unconstitutional. And also, I can go to 42 U.S.C. 12181, which says when a private entity opens its doors to the public, it's no longer private, becomes a public entity. So they deny you access to the store, you can charge them against 42 U.S.C. 1983-84-85. Your constitutional rights. A lot of people don't know these things. It's important that they start learning things. It really is. So that's what I want to say.
Yeah, thank you. There was a pastor named Chuck Baldwin. He ran for president. I don't know if you remember him. He moved. Yeah. He was in Florida, and he ended up moving to Montana. But he preached for years against the 501(c). Anybody wants to look him up, Chuck Baldwin has a couple of really good sermons about that.
Yeah.
I don't...
You don't want to be part of the government auspices, because then when you could go to Romans 13, with the way it's interpreted, it's actually factual, if you're under 501(c)(3). You have to abide by what they say. See? That's
right.
And that's she shouldn't do that. The church is supposed to be independent from all that stuff.
That's right.
The people are, well, again, the 10th Amendment, all power goes to the state, or the people respectively. Well, the state's a dead entity. It doesn't exist unless it's the people, period.
Right.
The people make the state. That's how come the people in Illinois are basically considered, quote-unquote, sovereign. we're supposed to tell people. And so they should actually abide by the Constitution, which is based on God's laws. The Constitution is a contract, by the way. It's a covenant.
Right.
It's a written covenant. And we got to realize that it's also based on God's Ten Commandments and His laws. So that's what I want to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have Robert up next. Gorman. Go ahead, Robert. You've been unmuted.
Yes. Hello. It's been a long time since I called in. A couple, three things I want to mention. About the first thing you were talking earlier about the sheriff's jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
All officers have, you look at their oath of office, they try to get out of it by not signing it properly today. But what they do say is they're going to defend the state constitution and the national constitution. So a sheriff does have jurisdiction over national matters.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. And that's where okay. It comes in. It comes into the oath. You're right.
Yes. And the other thing I want to tell you, too, is before I get into the COVID thing, it's very important what I want to tell you about this, about the COVID thing, about the LOCS, July 21st, CDC alert to the nation. It's being hidden from the public, what's really going on. And I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. But first, I want to tell you about the Romans 13. There is, it's called the Concordant Publishing Concern. They have, had a ministry for well over 100 years now. And they're now in Michigan. They used to be in California. And they just finished, after preparing it for 100 years, the Old Testament. It has the Hebrew language and the English language. And they have it's called the Concordant New Testament. And Romans 13 says it this way. The way they translate is like the fellow Brett was talking about, and then other fellows calling in here, is saying there is no authority if not of God. So there are some authorities that are not of God. You don't obey them. You still there?
Yes.
Okay. The last thing I want to tell you about is the COVID-19. If you remember, 2 years ago when it first started coming out, Dr. Kerry Mullis, who developed the PCR test that they're using right now,
mm-hmm.
It diagnosed millions upon millions of people as having COVID-19. And if you look at it very carefully, barely more than 3% of the people who were diagnosed positive had symptoms. They're still diagnosed with COVID-19. It's computer simulation. That's how it's programmed. But then you even had Dr. Fauci come out. When Dr. Kerry Mullis said that, he went on national news, and he said, I want to debate Dr. Fauci. He is lying to the American public. You cannot use my test to diagnose disease with my test. It's not for that purpose. Now, I understand. I try to get the library to find this out. I believe he died August 7th of 19, but they cannot find the date that he made that public statement on national news that he wanted to debate Fauci and he accused him of lying to the American people. I was told by a Navy veteran I'm a guest with right now, staying with him, he said it was a week before. So it's possible, very possible, when he came out with that, he wanted to debate Fauci, show it's a false test. They killed him. I can't prove it because I can't understand why the date isn't available when he made that statement, because I haven't recorded that statement because I heard it 2 years ago. So then also Fauci comes on after that, and he actually says to reporters, medical reporters, he said it's correct. If you set that PCR test between 35 and 45 cycles, you can't see anything. You can't culture up anything. And that's how they're setting that test at that. Now, here comes the alert. When you hear this, it's going to show that COVID-19 is a total a weapon. This whole thing is a weapon against the people. It says in it, July 21st, LOCS notice. Let's see, I'm going to try to remember what it means, LOCS. It's a lab Outreach Communication Service, and it's a notice to all labs in this country, and it says in there, as of December 31st of this year, 21, all labs are doing testing for the COVID-19. We've requested from the FDA, this is a CDC notice, we're requesting from the CDC to withdraw emergency authorization use of that test. Nobody knew that test is not even lawful, and that's why, because Dr. Carrie Mullis, who developed the test, said it's not right, proper. So they're admitting it now in this notice that the public doesn't really see, unless you know how to find it. It says we're going to withdraw request to the FDA, that's the CDC, we're going to drop this test as of December 31st, and here's how we know it was an improper test, like Dr. Carrie Mullis said, and it says now all these labs are going to continue doing the testing, but with the standard tests that were available. That means a standard electron microscope test that will show stuff, but it's not going to show no COVID-19 because it's a computer simulation. It doesn't exist. It's a cartoon. What it's going to show is, like Dr. I'm getting a little nervous, I'm sorry, but you probably know about this lawsuit. I'll think of his name in a minute. Derek Knauss, K-N-A-U-S-S. What he did was, you'll see this, you can find this on Google. He tested 1,500 positive cases of COVID, UCLA, and he used a standard electron microscope test. And that's what they're going to do now after December 31st now, nationally. But he already did this before that. And he says he didn't find one case of COVID-19 that were diagnosed COVID-19 with a PCR test. He used standard electron microscope test and COVID something he was using. You go by symptoms, too. So what he did was he sent his results to seven major medical schools in this country. You're going to be able to see this when you download this website I'm going to give you to find it. And they didn't find any COVID-19 either. They found the influenza A and B or nothing. That's all it was with the standard electron microscope. And if you got diagnosed standard influenza A or B, that's no big problem. You've had this for decades. And so, but they don't want that. They want you to have this new novel terrifying COVID-19. So everybody's going to be diagnosed. So here's what they did. And they sent it to Canals in the seven major medical schools. They sent it on to 24 international virologists and biologists to do the same tests on those 1,500 samples. They found the same results. No COVID-19. So they all got together and they sent an official mandamus to the CDC. They said, we want to see samples of your COVID-19 virus. The answer was, we have none. There is none. So they all got together and they filed a lawsuit that you're not going to see in mainstream. And they're accusing the CDC of fraud and a coup d'etat against the United States of America. It's just a continuation of 9/11 attack on this country to bring it down. So we'll finish up with this 7/21. July 21st of 21, here's what they've done. They get this false positive test on millions of people to get them to take the shots. Now, this person I'm staying with, a Navy veteran, his former wife and daughter are nurses in a Jacksonville, Florida hospital. And I remember hearing it over a year ago, too, the same thing. People are coming in there, they can't breathe. And also, I remember in New York City when this first came out, the hospital were putting them on ventilators. One doctor and this one nurse, I forgot her name, was a Polish name, is saying, we can't understand this. These people are turning blue. They can't breathe. Well, if you go on BitChute, you'll see Dr. Jane Ruby talking about this. They're taking these people, getting these shots, and they're taking their blood and they're putting on these platelets and they're looking at their blood. And their blood cells are being destroyed. And those cells carry oxygen. So what's going to happen, what I'm getting at here, Gerard, is this. What they're doing is, after December 31st, they're going to the correct test that they could have used right from the beginning that would have showed just influenza. But now you got millions and millions of people that are going to get sick from these shots. And now, after December 31st, they're going to the correct test, and there's going to be a lot of sick people now. But they couldn't use the correct test in the beginning. They had to use a test that's going to show false positive for 97% of all the cases that were diagnosed positive COVID-19. And then you so now this lawsuit you can look up by Dr. Derek Canals, if you don't know it already, I figured you fellows would know, is you go on Google, if it's still there, and here's what it says. You just write this in, I'm a clinical lab scientist, comma, COVID-19 is fake, comma, wake up America. That's where you'll find that lawsuit against the CDC by the seven major medical schools, Dr. Canals and Michelle Kostowski, and the 24 international biologists and virologists. And then this other thing, how you find that, you just go to LOCS, and you'll see the July 21st, 21. It says right on there, the heading of it. It's a CDC alert to all the lab technicians in this country. You're going to now change to the normal other tests that were normally and lawfully available all along. So they lied. They said if we didn't even know this, that test is, as well as the vaccines weren't FDA approved. And by the way, before I forget, they came out just a few days ago saying that Pfizer vaccine is approved. It's another deception, Gerard, because they got a new Pfizer drug vaccine that's not even available. That's the one that's approved, not the one they're still giving out. So the other one comes out, so that one is still not approved. That's what I want to say. Do you have any questions? I hope I didn't confuse you about anything. Are you still there? Hello?
I can see he's on the call. I'm just not sure why he can't hear.
Ma'am, did you hear what I said?
Yes, you're broadcasting just fine.
All right, ma'am. My name is Walt, and your name, please?
Francine.
Francine. It's very difficult about this July 21st CDC alert. We're going back after December, or they're going back. They never did. They're going to be transferring over to the real legitimate test. Standard electron microscope test is going to show things, but only with the people. Now there's going to be sicknesses developing. See, they had to wait over a year to get millions and millions of people vaccinated, and then they're going to be getting sick, going into hospitals, and they're going to be tested, and you're going to see real bad stuff. And what they're going to do is, what I didn't tell Gerard is, they're going to blame on the mainstream media the unvaccinated. But here's how you can prove what's going on. Take the people that aren't vaccinated today, right? You give them that PCR test, 97%, they're going to have it. They won't even be sick. But then if you give the same people the standard electron microscope test, there ain't going to be nothing there. And if they got a little cold or something, you may have influenza A or B. That's all they're going to have. Because if you go to BitChute, I don't know if you folks know about this website called BitChute. I'll spell it. It's B as in boy, I-T-C-H-U-T-E. When you go there, you'll be there for months if you don't know about it, catching up with all that's going on. And a real good doctor, there's many, many. As a matter of fact, if you don't know about this, Vladimir Zadowski, a Jewish doctor in New York City, I just saw his video about a week ago on Sunday. It was live. Had a conference call with the health ministry in the state of Israel. And they were talking there, and 85% of the people are vaccinated over there. And the doctor, Vladimir, was telling the health professionals over there, he says, you're admitting 11,000 people already died. I'm getting inside information that 45 or 50,000 died from the shots already. And he says the vice president of Pfizer stepped down, Michael Yadin, recently. He don't want no part of it, and he, of his own vaccine, and the company was vice president, the top scientist, he gave a vaccine, says, and he can't say this, but he did. He says in 3 years, those people are going to be dead to take those shots. That's all on BitChute. So that's what's going on. And Dr. Jan Ruby, she's very good. And she was, they're looking at these blood samples on the platelets of people getting these shots, getting sick, and you could see the electron charges are being altered from these shots, and that's why you see on the BitChute videos, You got a lot of people with metal spoons and knives sticking to their bodies after they get these shots. And then you could see these blood cells, nine of them or so, clumped together. That's going to cause blood clots. And then also the people aren't going to be able to breathe. So you're going to see a lot of people in the emergency rooms having trouble breathing, and that's because they're getting those shots. And they're going to put on the mainstream media that the people that they're getting sick in the emergency rooms are the ones not getting the shots. And are you still there, man? There's one more thing I have to tell you, very important, from the Navy base here in Jacksonville, Florida. I talked to the supervisor of the emergency department. I want to tell you what he told me.
Part two. Okay, did he come back on? I don't see.
I don't
see him. Yeah. If I saw him, I'd unmute him. But anyway, what he was saying is absolutely true.
Yeah, no, I apologize. That was my fault. I meant to click leave. And I clicked end call. I'm sorry about that.
I thought it was the emergency broadcast notice.
No, I was just like, I'm going to leave a couple minutes early today.
And so were all of us, too, so that's okay. Anyway, I think there's Rhonda in the... In the queue, I can go to her. This whole COVID thing is going to get crazier and crazier as fall and winter comes along. And the problem is I just want to state this, that whenever they did testing of this so-called vaccine, they've always been trying to make a vaccine for the common cold, for the coronavirus, and it's always failed, because what happens is they give whenever they gave the inoculations, then the last step is to reintroduce the wild virus again and see what happens to everybody that got the vaccine. And what happened in the animal testing is when they came into contact with the wild germ, or whatever you want to call it, their immune system went into a cytostorm and overreacted, and it killed every one of the animals, and they had to stop it. So basically, anybody that's going to happen now to anybody that took the vaccine, even if they didn't get any serious side effects from it initially, when that wild virus comes back through, they're gonna get very sick and they're gonna die. And this is what's happening in Israel. Those people that are in the hospitals, they're all vaccinated people. That's what they're not telling you. You know, they have one of the highest percentages of vaccine rates in that country, and yet they're all sick and dying because now they're getting infected with the spike protein. And basically, that vaccine was the bioweapon. And so it's allowing the virus to mutate, because it's not killing it, and it's sitting in there and it's making spike protein, and they're going to shed that. And I do believe that even people that didn't get the vaccine are going to catch the cold. Although if you got the vaccine, you're not going to survive it. It's going to be much worse. And that's what Yeardon said. He said you got 2 to 3 years and they'll all be dead. Of course, there's stuff out there that they're doing that is fighting that spike protein, like pine needle tea, ashemic acid. The Health Ranger has a lot of that on there, and a lot of this stuff wasn't known even by the scientists when they first came out. So Yeardon is not familiar with this. So, she said Robert Gordon is back on in the room. Robert, if you want to get into the queue, go ahead, and I'll give you a couple of seconds here to finish up what you were saying. I kind of knew where you were going anyway, because I've heard this stuff.
He's actually unmuted, Gerard. He can talk where he is.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead and finish your...
Yes, are you there?
There you go. Yeah, I am. Yeah, we all got knocked off, so we're back now. So if you want to just finish your what you were saying there, I'll let you finish.
Okay, the last part about the Navy base, you mean?
Yeah, I think that's what you were on.
Okay, it was the very last thing, guys. Some lady, you were gone, and some lady was in the audience. Says they heard everything I said. That's good. Okay, on July 2nd, I went to the Jacksonville, Florida Navy base. The person I'm a guest with, his son had an infection in his toe, so we went to the emergency room, and I presented some of these documents, the Derek Canales lawsuit about the face mask or don't work at all this stuff. And the supervisor for the emergency department came out. His name is Ron, and he says, you know, I knew something was wrong when this whole thing started with the COVID-19. He said this. He said, there hasn't been one case of regular flu since this started. Not one since it started. That's because the PCR test does not show anything. It shows a simulated COVID-19 virus that does not exist. That Dr. Cohen you were talking about earlier, I believe, Thomas Cohen, there's also a book called The Invisible Rainbow. You'll see military information in there saying there's no viruses that are transferring through the air, and it is an electron problem. 1918, Spanish flu, they turned all the telephones on for the first time.
Yeah.
57, all the extra radar stations after World War II started the next flu, the Asian flu, and so on. And now we got all these smart meters outside your house, like having an open microwave oven going right in your body, could put stress in your body, and the viral genomes your body makes itself to get rid of disease. That's part of your tools your body makes.
And don't forget, 5G is also causing it, too.
That's what I meant. I forgot that word. That's right, Gerard. It's the 5G is the latest thing. So Fauci and Bill Gates and all the rest of them and also are involved with, and they knew about this. And also one more important thing. Anybody gets a copy of Henry Ford's book from 1922, you're going to see it. They try to kill him 3 times for what he said in his book. They shut down his newspaper company. That book is still banned in countries in Europe. It was banned in his country. It says right he found out, Gerard, that the international bankers are going to use vaccines with disease in it to destroy this nation. And when he came out with that book, they tried to kill him, his wife, and his children 3 times. If people don't know, you can order at Barnes & Noble's, the book. It's only $10.
Right.
So that's all. So what do you do about it, right? So I told 3 sheriffs already. They can't. I talked to 3 of them. They say it's outside my jurisdiction, so I'm going to put a complaint against all 3 of them. They say, yeah, okay, but I can't do nothing about it. You got to go to the feds. They talk like that.
No. That's where they're wrong. I mean,
they're all afraid. They're afraid. Another person in the county says, I gotta feed my family, talking like that. So I understand. They're afraid.
Well, guess what? This is war. We're at war, basically.
Yes. Now, can I say one more thing real quick? Do I have time?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to speak to you off air. I'll give you my phone number. Anybody wants, because when I'm going to say this, it's so controversial, it's causing all the race problems in this world. Here's my phone number, 585-406-0160. Now, here's what I'm going to tell you. It's mind-blowing. It goes back to Genesis 3:15. It's a secret race war. When King David fought Goliath, 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 42, it tells you right there that Goliath and him were different races, and it said that David was a white man. And also, Nathan the prophet says this, Gerard, are you ready? Says that your seed is going to come down through the generations, is going to run the kingdom on earth, of the Almighty on earth, and he has to be the same bloodline. He has to be a white man. That's why they want to get rid of the white, because they know who's got to come down, and they can't stop it. The Almighty in heaven's going to make sure that David's descendant is the same thing, flesh and blood descendant of King David. Look at it. Says it doesn't say the word white. It says ruddy. That means blushing red in the face. And Adam blushes red in the face. I hope nobody's offended by that. You can check it out right in the scriptures.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
I'll talk to you later. Bye bye.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, it's after 12, so I guess we can shut down for real now. So. It's been good, everybody. Thank you for a very lively show, to say the least. And I'll stop the recording if my mouse starts working. Somebody want to hit the recording button?